Welcome to Project GFK. CSI Dallas presents The Journey. It is Saturday, November the 4th, 2023, and this will be our last Journey meeting prior to the 60th anniversary conference in Dallas, Texas. And we're going to talk about that here in just a minute. I do want to let everybody know that, hey, my sister knows I'm in a JFK, so she sent me a link, and there's a new show that's going to be coming out for those of you that are interested. It's going to be on National Geographic. Yeah, it's National Geographic. It's JFK One Day in America. It's going to premiere this Sunday night at 7 o'clock Central. It's a three-night event. I don't know if anybody is aware of it or not. They are going back to some of the eyewitnesses. I saw Clint Hill in the preview. You can get the video of that on YouTube. It's also going to be streamed, it looks like, on Hulu and Disney Plus, for those of you that have that streaming service or those services. I'm going to watch it and see just what they have to say. Is it going to be the same old that they do every year, or is there going to be new information? I understand there's going to be newly digitized, colored, photographs and videos. So I'm excited to see what they put together. Let's see. We're going to start off with, the website. So let me screen share here real quick. It'll be one of those days, folks. All right. There we go. For our audience in attendance and those on YouTube watching this in rerun or repeat, replay, you can go to projectjfk.com for all the latest news, information, things that we are working on, who we're in collaborations with. We do have a donate button on our homepage. Want to stress that if anybody likes what we're doing, want to keep the lights on, hey, it's our shameless plug to please donate and help us keep the mission going. I want to click on the events tab. The events tab is where you will find all of our events that we're doing, the upcoming things. And once you scroll past today's event, you will come across the conference that will be held virtually on Zoom and in Dallas, Texas. If you would like to receive, if you'd like to purchase a ticket for either the in-person or the Zoom portion, you can click on the Find Out More tab. It will take you over to the JFK Historical Group site. You can click on conferences, or you can scroll down, whichever you like. This is the schedule that is the most up-to-date. I don't believe there's been any changes made, but David's always tweaking those. But Thursday, November the 16th, we kick off with registration in person at 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock. The conference will go live at 3 p.m., virtually and in person. It will go until about 7:05 with our closer that day of Dick Russell. Friday morning, we will start at 8:45 in the morning. We will go until 6:40. Saturday the 19th, we start off at 8:55 with Shauna Willis. We will end that evening with the banquet around 8 o'clock. There are some events scheduled for Sunday that will not be shown on the portion of Zoom. I will be traveling to come home that day. But there are some information. There is some information for Sunday, November 19th for those that want to stay in Dallas and take part in those. If you're interested in doing that, we encourage you to do so. Tickets are still available for the in-person and the Zoom portion. Now, I do want to stress this. On the Zoom portion, you're paying for the live event. This would be like if you were to, you know, pay for a live event online at any other streaming service. Now, the only difference is we do not have replay capabilities. So if you want to, you know, participate, come in, you know, virtually on Zoom, be able to ask questions, that you can, if you have a question you want to ask the speaker, it's a whole lot easier to show up in person on Zoom. And when there's Q&A times allowed, or if there's a certain question you want answered, I can always write it on a note card, give it to the particular speaker. They can give their response, or they can email you directly with the answer to your question. This is not something that you will have in the replay. You will have to track down that speaker to ask questions. The hotel, from what I understand, I talked to David Denton yesterday, we are out of hotel rooms. We are trying to get some more rooms for the discounted rate. If not, there is a hotel right across the street. It's not as fancy as the DoubleTree, but I believe it's going to be a lot cheaper. And if I have to get an overflow booking of those rooms across the street at the Days Inn, we will address that as more people sign up. But there's still plenty of room for attendees to attend in person, and there's definitely enough room for you all on Zoom. Let's see here. Still many people in. Let's go back to the JFK Prodigy JFK website. I want to let people know. Can you all see the Prodigy JFK website up on the screen? Give me a thumbs up. All right. If you scroll past the conference, a new portion that was just put up this morning, it's the JFK Historical Group in association with Project JFK CSI Dallas presents an evening of remembrance and reflection of the 60th anniversary of the JFK assassination. Now, what's nice about this, again, it's going to be in your living room, on your desktop or on your laptop, tablet or phone. November the 21st, 2023 at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time. Everybody, don't forget, in the United States, depending on where you live at, be sure to set your clocks back 1 hour. You get to gain sleep tonight. And those of us that are going to be watching the Kansas City Chiefs game tomorrow morning at 8:30, since they're playing in Germany, we're going to want that extra hour of sleep. But the special guest for this event is going to be the evening before. So kind of picture the idea of JFK landing in Fort Worth before he travels to Dallas, Texas, on the morning of the 22nd. This is our eve of the assassination. The special guests are going to be David Denton, Casey Quinlan, Brian Edwards, and myself. And for those that have attended our journey meetings, towards the end, we're going to open it up and we can have some discussions back and forth. So there's been a lot of stuff going on the last week of October, all this month of November. And we will definitely have another journey meeting. I do not have the date picked out just yet. Be sure to click on the little click for e-ticket sign up for that the evening of the 21st event. But we will be having something in the month of December. But again, it's for me, it's my finals, the first 2 weeks of the month, and coming back from Dallas doing the conference videos. I'm going to have my hands full, so we will definitely have one, but we've got Christmas in there too, guys. So, with everybody traveling, I'm hoping we can have a journey meeting either right before or right after Christmas. Hell, we might be celebrating New Year's together. All right, let me see who I've got here in the room. I'm working without a mouse today, guys. I'm having to use the touchpad. My damn mouse is not connecting. That always sucks. Okay, I don't see David Denton in the room, but Dave, for those of you that know David Denton, every Halloween he does something of a thing on Facebook. It was always funny to see 007 last year. This year he did the Dark Knight. Hopefully he will have time to join us today. If you get a chance to look up his Facebook page, he did some campy acting, but it was fun. So let's see here. We are missing Casey. I know he's doing well. I'm sure he's got some stuff going on with church. He's been a busy kind of guy here lately, and he's preparing for the conference like we all are. Brian, I'm going to start off with you. You wanted to show us some little tidbits that some people maybe have not seen before. So why don't I go ahead and give it to you, and you let us know what you got.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Dave. Gary and I are just about to the point where we can raise our hands and say, yippee, we're done, and it's in the publisher's hands now for the book. the Roscoe White story. He's given me permission to show you a few pictures, kind of to tease you a little bit of one of the pictures, some of the pictures that we got for from Ricky, the Roscoe's son. He's graciously allowed us to copy them and put them in the book. Not all the pictures I'm going to show you are going to be in the book, but some of them have never been seen before outside the White family. So I'm going to share my screen and let you see some of these pictures. It was very humbling to see these pictures, you know, knowing the Roscoe White story, and then seeing these pictures, you get a different glimpse inside this man's life. So let me share screen. Where is it? Right there. Ah. Okay. Like I said, I'm not going to show you every picture, because that would be make you want to buy the book if you don't see the pictures. Hang on, now I didn't get that set up right. Okay, I can't. How do I stop that? Stop sharing. Okay, let me fix that. Sorry about that. I forgot I had those on autoplay. So anyway, in the meantime, let me fix these. These are, okay, it just closed on me. That's bizarre. David, give me a second and I'll fix this.
Okay, I can vent for a minute while you're working on that.
I don't know where they went.
Okay, so, let's see. Want to throw this out there also. For those of you that have signed up for the conference, there is a small group of people that have signed up for the hotel, but they haven't signed up for the actual conference yet. So if you haven't signed up for the conference, if you're going to pay in person, that's great. Not a problem. But be sure to sign up either in person, pay in person, or sign up online so we know who is going to be at our event. And also, I want to stress this, for those of you that only paid for the conference, and they have not paid for the banquet or the lunches, during those times, so we can keep track of who is a lunch or dinner, you know, ticket holder that has paid for that, the room will be emptied before, each dinner. And then everybody will go out in the room. They will take their ticket stub, hand it to the person at the door, get their plate, come back in and pick their seat. Whether it's the same seat they sit at all during the conference, or they want to sit someplace else, we are going to have some speakers strategically placed at tables. So those of you that signed up early, you're going to get first dibs to sit, you know, in sort of assigned seating. We're still working out the details on that. But we want to push the fact that we have to give the hotel 3 to 5 days heads up of how many people are going to be eating at the conference. If we have a rush at the very end and they don't have enough food, guess what? Then you're not going to be able to take part in the lunches or the dinners. You won't hear those speakers. And we're going to have keynote speakers for each one of our lunches and our dinner, obviously. You aren't going to want to miss that. So, you know, if you're holding out until the very end, the end is here, or the end is near. So you want to make sure that you, if you're interested in coming to the lunches or the dinner, please buy your ticket now, so that way we can get a head count and we make sure we have food for everybody. You ready to go now, Brian?
Go ahead.
All right, I can keep rolling here.
I don't know why it's not, you know, not sure why it's not working here.
This is part of the deal. Joe, I see you got your hand up. You wanna say something here?
Yeah, could you let me share a screen for a second?
Yeah, if you want to, go ahead. Brian's still working, so
yeah, I'm working.
Okay, I just put this in the chat, a little gift for everyone.
Ah, we love gifts.
Okay. Can you see what this is, an Excel database?
Yeah, you got RIP numbers here, I see. IDs. Please explain.
If you go to NARA's website, Archives 2 NARA website, there's a page about additional documentation on stuff that they want to continue to redact. And the CIA has an index. This is that CIA index. But I gave you hot links to all the RIF numbers. That's what that is. And
now, are these only CIA
And I gave
documents?
You document titles here. Now, the CIA wants you to think that this is all that they're redacting or that they're not releasing quite yet, even though some of this says released in the fall. There's about 13, let me, there's about 11,514. And they're not just CIA documents. They're from several other agencies, FBI, a couple other different agencies in here. So you can have fun with that for November.
Now, let me ask you, Joe, now are these ones that they are wanting, so everybody in the audience understands, because some of us are not, some of the people are not up on the document part, so please give us some information. Are these the ones that they are, you know, these are some of these, some of the ones that they're wanting to keep suppressed, or
yes.
Are they still, is there?
CIA is basically taking control of the entire process from here on out. JFK Act is kaput, and the CIA is taking charge of this whole process. And if you go to that website on NARA, you'll see some letters from the agencies to the archive or the president. Now there's some of them, they'll have an index. The largest index by far is the CIA one, and that's this about 12,000 documents. But these are all linked to at least a version of them on Mary Farrell. So there's at least a version that's been released so far.
So all right, good.
Get any one of those and get to a version of it on Mary Farrell.
Good work. We appreciate that that list that you put together. And I like the hot links.
So that's it.
All right.
That's a lot of work, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Yep. So take it away. How do I unshare now? Stop share. Okay, stop share. Back to you.
You still working there, Brian?
Yeah, I'll just do it manually. I don't know why the slides aren't advancing, but I'll just share it. Anyway, how can I see what I'm looking at here? Is it coming through at all?
Yeah, I see Foreman High School, Foreman, Arkansas, 7th grade,
okay.
Roscoe,
48. This was a picture, obviously. This is a picture of Roscoe when he was in 7th grade. He moved to, or his mother took him to live with his maternal grandfather in Foreman, Arkansas, and he entered high school at seventh grade. That's the way they did it back 7 through 12 when you were in high school. It's interesting to see this little kid here, and then knowing his fate in history. It's kind of interesting to just look at those two together. Here's the. You see that? It's a football picture, right?
Yep.
Okay.
I got it.
What's interesting about this is when Ricky played football for Paris High School, he wore number 26, not knowing that his dad wore 26 when he played in Arkansas. So it's kind of a weird mojo kind of going on. But anyway, Roscoe was such a good football player he as a junior, he played on the varsity team and got a scholarship offer to the Arkansas Razorbacks, but he declined and he had other, I guess he had other plans going to the military. Here's his graduation picture. He's a good looking kid. Graduated not at the top of his class, but was able to give the graduation speech. And Ricky's had the 3x5 cards, the original 3x5 cards that his dad actually wrote out in his own hand, and then he types it. And we've got that in the collection, which is kind of cool. So he graduates high school. Let me show you this one. He marries a 15-year-old girl in Paris, Texas, and they go off to Arkansas to Oklahoma, to Hugo, Oklahoma, right across the Red River, and got married. Didn't tell anybody for a couple of days, so that didn't go over too well. But anyway, as soon as he turned 18. Roscoe enlisted in the Marine Corps, and he and his brother-in-law, Geneva's oldest brother, Benny, they went to Dallas recruiting station of the Marines and entered on the buddy system. And I'm still trying to figure out what the buddy system is. I guess you stay with your buddy until you get your orders, but they went through boot camp together. Benny Toland turned into a... how's the word I want to say it nicely? A criminal. he had some problems in the Marines, and then they shipped him out, and he ended up back in Paris doing some things he shouldn't have been doing. But anyway, the two of them entered the Marine Corps together. Benny ended up in Hawaii, and Roscoe went wherever he went. Let's see. Here's a photo booth someplace in, probably in San Diego, where he got a picture. He just got his private first class stripes. So this was about 1957, before he shipped out to the Far East. This one, I'm going to show you this one. It's kind of neat. So they're obviously not worried about the shaving. So I'm thinking they're someplace in the field or something, but I've never served in the military, but I would have thought that, you know, even in the Marine Corps, you're clean shaven and not today like the Navy SEALs. Hell, they've got beards, and Delta Forces got, you know, long hair, but I guess back then you could have a beard and if you're out in the field. But anyway, we don't know what that was all about. So Geneva, we've all seen this famous picture of Geneva and Jack Ruby, and Ricky told the House Senate Committee that, yes, that was his mother. And then Gary found this picture in the Warren Commission documents. This was at Jack Ruby's Vegas Club, or Club Vegas, I should say. And that's Geneva there. So Ricky said that there was times when Geneva would put on her cowboy boots and her honky-tonk outfit, and she'd leave her husband in Paris, Texas, and then go to Dallas and do honky-tonking. So she got around, let's say. I never got a chance to meet her. She obviously, she died in 91, but she was Gary got a chance to talk to her, and Bill Klaver interviewed her, and then, she passed away in 91, right after a big article in Texas Monthly Magazine. Here's a picture of the White's family without the toupee. Roscoe was known to wear a toupee on more than one occasion. And in fact, he told his minister he wore a toupee to disguise himself on when he was working. And of course, the follow-up question was never asked. What do you mean you disguised yourself when you were working? Working for who? Working with what? Where were you working, at a business, or were you working for the government, or what were you doing? I never did ask that question. Here's a picture of Roscoe with a toupee. and this was obviously taken in September 72, is printed on the side of the photograph. That's the date it was printed. Roscoe died September 23rd, 1971. So this is obviously post-death, but it's interesting because without toupee in 65, here's one with the toupee. And what's interesting is that whether you believe Beverly Oliver's story or not, it doesn't matter. She said that when President Kennedy was shot, she looked across the street and immediately saw Roscoe coming down the steps and then walking at an angle towards the sidewalk. He didn't have a hat on, and she saw that he had his hair was all over the place, and she recognized him only as Geneva's husband. She didn't know his first name because she was never introduced to him. But she said he had hair on his head, but it was all over the place, like it was either underneath a hat or, you know, windblown or whatever it might be. But so without and with. So that was kind of interesting to see those. Let me show you this one since we're teasing you a little bit. This picture on the left, Gary and I sat and looked at that for an hour trying to figure out where is this place. We're thinking, you know, with the pencil protector that he's, you know, when he quit the police department, he supposedly was going to go to work for Page's Drugstore. Well, he actually didn't work for Page's Drugstore for about 3 months after he quit. But we thought maybe he was, you know, in the back room of the drugstore, and, you know, he's all suited up and got his hair all pretty. Come to find out, this is a hair salon for men. That's a barber chair he's sitting in. And in the background on the wall are samples of, you know, everybody in the picture has what obviously looks like toupees. So we asked Ricky, you know, did your dad ever go and get his hair done? He says, oh, God, all the time. Like once a month he'd go and get it tightened down or whatever, combed and coiffed and all that. So that's where that's at. And then he had this professional photograph done. I'm not sure what the purpose of this was, but Roscoe did work for two insurance companies before he joined the police department, so maybe he did this before 1971, but I don't know what the point of getting this one professional done, but obviously he used it for some reason. But that was interesting. Here it is. Here, compared to this picture with the little air wings on the side, I mean, he obviously got it all fixed up here. My dad even had a hair piece, and he had to go once a month to get it, because they weave it into your existing hair, what little you have, and then as your hair grows, it becomes loose. So Roscoe would have to go get that done to keep that nice trim look on his hair. This is where he was injured. This is the Eminem, used to be the Eminem equipment and rental company, and they worked on big machines like Caterpillars and road scrapers and backhoes and all that sort of thing. Roscoe was a welder, and that's the two doors to the shop, and that's where he was injured on the 23rd of September 1971. He died the next day of cardiac arrest, but this is the place. It's still there. I took this about 4 years ago. It's still there. Now it's a tree service, which is interesting because Ricky White has his own tree service. So again, another weird coincidence. This is Roscoe's death certificate, and on the left is the funeral announcement, and on the right is the actual death certificate. We had to apply for a FOIA to get that. With Ricky's consent, but it shows, you know, some specifics about when he died and how he died and where he died. But we also got the Dallas Police Department's incident report and the Dallas Fire Department's incident report. And I can tell you from a law enforcement officer's perspective, they suck. They don't say anything. They just give you the location, who died or who was injured. And it doesn't say what the cause was. There was one half a page of narrative, and it didn't tell you a damn thing. But it's interesting that this has got, this death certificate's got more information on it than the fire or the police report. And interestingly, on a side note, the officer who, one of the officers that responded to the emergency at the business was, I knew I was going to forget it. The guy that was escorting the three tramps, the first guy, somebody help me out with that. Anyway, he was the officer that wrote the report, and thought that was kind of interesting. Ricky shared with us this picture. This is Richardson. When they moved to Richardson, and they were living in Richardson in that time Roscoe died. This is the spring of 72, Miss Worley's fourth grade class at Richardson Heights Elementary School. There's Ricky in the background, and this young lady in the front row is Rachel Oswald.
Wow.
They walked to school together every day, he said. And I thought that was interesting that the teacher here in the upper left corner had two people connected to the Kennedy assassination, probably didn't even know it. But it wasn't too long after this that Marina changed, when she married Ken Porter, she changed the girls' names, their last names also, so they wouldn't be known as the Oswalds again. But I thought that was interesting that when I asked Ricky, I said, well, did you know her? He goes, oh, hell, I walked to school with her every day. We lived two blocks apart. Thought that was kind of interesting. And there's Roscoe's gravesite in the Field of Honor at Restland Memorial Park in Dallas. And it's interestingly enough, when Geneva died, she was also buried in the Field of Honor, but not next to Roscoe. You know, does anybody know who was buried right next to Roscoe, whose headstone is like right here? Anybody know? John Liggett. Everybody knows this. Some of you know the John Liggett story. He was a mortician that worked at Park or at Restland and was supposedly involved, the men who killed Kennedy, the episode, the sixth or seventh chapter of that episode, they talked to Liggett's wife, and he was an interesting character. They knew each other, according to Ricky, and according to a lot of documents that Ed Tatro sent us. Liggett would also often have a high-stakes poker party at his house. And one of the guest lists that Ed Tatro found was Liggett, Roscoe, Jack Ruby, and one of the politicians in Dallas, nobody that's involved in the Kennedy assassination, but some big name, you know, big mover and shaker would show up at Liggett's house and they'd have a high stakes poker game. But I thought it was interesting that Geneva is like, I don't know, 15 feet from Roscoe's headstone. Thought that was kind of weird.
Hey, Brian, are you talking about Officer Billy Bass?
That's it. No, the other one. Who's the other one?
Well, Billy Bass was the one that was in front. The one that was Marvin Wise.
That's it. That's who wrote the report, Marvin Wise. This is the best picture we have of the cables, the three plain text cables that Ricky found in his canister in his grandparents' attic. And inside it was this laminated, plastic. It's really not laminate because it was way before its time. This is some kind of clear plastic, flexible. It looks like plastic overlay, but the cables were sealed inside them. Also inside the canister were these. There was a single dog tag of Roscoe on it, Roscoe's name and his religion and blood type and all that. And then two newspaper clippings, of Jack Ruby from the Dallas Times Herald, and this is the Warren report being given to, Lyndon Johnson. So what's interesting is wonder why, you know, why did he put those in there? Was he trying to tell us that he was involved in this? You know, it's all open to interpretation, but I thought it was interesting that he chose these two newspaper clippings to put inside that canister. Well, also inside the canister were these were negatives, and thank you, David Knight, for enhancing these. These are, this is Roscoe's mother. And this is Roscoe's maternal grandfather, who we lived with in Foreman, Arkansas, because Roscoe's real father abandoned the family when he was a little baby. And then this is a picture of Roscoe's mother and her sister, Agnes, and then this other woman, Ricky didn't know who it was. But my point is, what we're trying to justify is, who owned the canister? Well, the guy that put his personal dog tag in it would be a good clue that he owned the canister. Pictures of family would indicate that maybe he owned the canister and these are my people. And so now you know who these, you know, if you know who these people are, you know who owned the canister. So there's a lot of speculation on our part, but a lot of it's supported by, you know, what Ricky's told us over the years. And here's the canister, and on the outside of that canister has a sequence of numbers, and one of them, the last two digits are 6-5. I don't know if that means that's the year it was manufactured, but this is a military grade steel cylinder, airtight and watertight, that they use to put firearm, you know, pistols and bullets and such that on ships so they wouldn't get wet. But Ricky told us he had a hell of a time, and Ricky's a big guy, and he had a hell of a time getting that lid off of that thing because it was so tight and it had been hidden for so many years. Also in that canister was this dictation course textbook that Roscoe used as a scrapbook, and he put pictures from newspaper clippings in this scrapbook, and here at the top of the inside cover is his name, R.A. White, and his military serial number, 166-6106. So that tells you that's who the owner, at least, of this book is. So, and it was found inside, you know, this canister. So, you know, the natural assumption is the Roscoe put personal belongings inside this canister to be found later. So, a couple more pictures. I don't know if anybody, here's this one. This is important. This is inside the back cover, and in Roscoe's handwriting, it says 28 people died from witness program. Take out the rest of people later. So, and it signed it, Roscoe Anthony White, right down here at the bottom. And then a series of numbers and dashes and dots and circles, and all this doesn't mean a damn thing to us, but it meant something to him. And he was writing it in code. So whatever that means to him was important enough that he wrote inside this book cover. But the witness program, and that's why Ricky called it a witness elimination book. But it's really not a witness elimination book. The people in the newspaper clippings of people that are in there, some of them died, some of them were killed. But we don't know their connection to Roscoe, and we, you know, he hasn't actually come out and say, okay, I killed this guy with a karate chop to the throat. I killed this guy with a knife. I killed this guy with a strangulation. But it just says there's 28 people died in this program. And inside that, Geneva had a list, of people who were involved in this witness program. And one of them was Patrick Dean. She wrote down Patrick Dean. Roscoe, obviously, and a young man who lived in Paris at the time by the name of Philip Jordan. And Philip Jordan was reputed to be either involved in the Office of Naval Intelligence or involved with the Mafia as kind of a scary guy, what Ricky characterized him as, a scary guy. And Philip's dead. Philip Jordan died several years ago, but we don't know his real story, but Ricky's friend interviewed him. We have 20 cassette tapes that I'm still going through of interviews that he did of Philip Jordan. So hopefully we'll get those put together in some type of transcript. Lastly, I want to just, I don't, hopefully this will work, David. I don't know if it will. It's a audio video interview. Oh, I guess it will. I don't know if anybody has seen this, but Ed Tatro sent this to us, last year. And it's, for some of you who know Mike Brownlow, he was, always in Dealey Plaza, hung around with Robert Groden, and, nice guy, always able, you know, willing to share a lot of information. But apparently he interviewed Hargis, in 2003, I think. And what he said corroborates what Beverly Oliver said. It corroborates, what, Ed Hoffman saw. So let me play just a snippet of it and, let you, hopefully you can hear it.
No, we can see it. We can't hear it, Brian.
Oh, here. Okay, so Hargis is here. This is Mike Brownlow.
We're all straight looking for it.
Okay, so Hargis is saying, I just let it play.
Two looks hot when there's so many people around at that time. The police officer that had arrived was just now getting around the building.
So out in the building.
Mm-hmm. Or surround the building.
And all parties, now when you looked up, toward the garage, you know, when you dismounted your motorcycle, you waited for some buses to pass before you actually ran up the Noble, is that correct?
Buses?
Yeah, some of the buses that were in the motorcade, or did you jump off and immediately ran up us?
I jumped off my motorcycle and immediately ran over across the street looking for something to possibly. Now, I don't know what went on behind me in the street. That's why I rode up there. But I don't think there's any buses that.
Well, the reason I asked that question, some of the researchers, they, you know, over here, they put so many different theories together about this. Some of them say that you actually waited until the press buses and the rest of the press cars passed before you ran up the glass. Normally, that was at least a minute.
No.
And I've always had trouble with that. I knew it wasn't that long.
No, it happened within seconds. I wouldn't say it's minutes. No. It happened within seconds.
That's what I thought. Now, I'll already let clear one thing real quick. When you got up to the grass and don't look by the little retainer wall, and you looked over and you saw some people. As the years that went by, especially since 1974, a man who I knew, as he was being a police officer, I met him the year he died. Some people say he's killed or murdered. I don't know. Roscoe White was a Dallas police officer. You knew him, right?
Yes,
And as you know, over the years, all these books that have been written by many researchers, they have claimed that there was a man behind the fence they called the Bad Man up on the grass and over.
No.
And they say that he shot the president, and a lot of them said it was Roscoe White. Now, I was already being one of the few people to know that Roscoe White was on the grass and over. When you saw him, what was he doing?
Roscoe White was doing like I was doing, looking for someone who was shot. He couldn't tell just like I couldn't.
That's right.
Where the shot was coming from.
Yes, and I have tried to tell, especially to people myself, being a researcher.
So what I find very interesting about that is we have cooperation from a veteran officer who says Roscoe was up on the knoll when he ran up there seconds after the shots were fired. What I find, not difficult to understand, but when I was in the academy, veteran officers didn't know who the hell we were because we were rookies. And the only way they would know us if they came into the class and taught us. There was 49 guys in the Roscoe's class, the police academies. How Hargis would know Roscoe White? Roscoe hadn't even started in the academy yet. He didn't start the academy until December the 4th. Roscoe was hired by the city of Dallas on October 16th, 1963. Didn't start the academy until December 4th, 1963, and graduated the academy February 28th, 1964. How the heck did Bobby Hargis know who Roscoe White was? That's been bothering me ever since I saw this video. But what's interesting is that he corroborated Roscoe was up on the knoll. Roscoe was not assigned anywhere because he wasn't even in the academy yet. So hopefully that's just enough of a tease for you that you'll buy the book when we get it done. We're hoping it'll be done by the conference, but it might be the first week of December when it's all said and done. But anyway, any questions, anybody want to ask me any questions about it, I'll be glad to answer if I could. Okay. All right. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Brian. I want to add in something. You were talking about the buddy system earlier in your rendition of photographs.
Right.
And the easiest way to explain it, because I asked my father about it back when he was alive. For those of you that have seen the movie Stripes, Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, I believe his name was.
Yeah.
When they went into enlistment, they came in as buddies. They went all the way through basic. Now, they were actually put in the same orders. But depending on if you had special skills or not, then you could get transferred to a different location than your buddy. If you didn't come in with a buddy, they usually paired you up with having a buddy when you first got into the service. So do they do the buddy system now? I don't know. I know back in, like, Korea, World War II, Vietnam, they had the buddy system. So there's just an add-in for you, Brian. Let's see here. Where are we going to go to next? Let's see. What's in the comments section? Here's one for you, Brian. If Roscoe was the assassin at all, why was he allowed to live until 1971? Yep, you're on mute, Brian.
That's a good question. Because most of the shooters were probably were killed, you know, within 24 hours. Roscoe was still working, doing work for whoever, you know, Office of Naval Intelligence, CIA, or whoever. He was still doing work for them, and that's probably why he was able to you know, keep above ground, is because he was still working. That's my guess. I don't know for sure, but he did say that when his minister visited him in the hospital after he was injured, he said he saw a person running from the shop that he'd worked with before. And prior to Roscoe's injury, he had mentioned that he wanted out. He wanted out of this program. And, you know, we've all seen enough mafia movies and enough, you know, covert operative movies. It's, you know, once you're in, you don't get out unless they kill you. So there was also speculation, according to Geneva's interview that she did with Bill Klaber, that Roscoe had threatened to go to Washington and tell the story, tell what he's been doing ever since the 60s. And I guess, you know, that may have been enough to say, no, you can't do that. You'll expose too much. So, you know, I don't. That's just my thought. Either he was still working for him and he was a valuable asset, and they kept him around until they found out that he wasn't going to be a valuable asset. He had changed. He had become a born again Christian and was trying to change his life. In fact, when Geneva went to New Orleans in the spring of 1971, she was approached by a man who she didn't know, and said, you need to tell your husband, Rock, and that was his nickname, you need to tell Rock that he's not getting out, and we've got other jobs for him, and if he doesn't contact us within 48 hours, we'll take it to the next level. So he probably figured out that, you know, somebody was going to come and get him one day. And he told his minister, you know, I forgive the man who did this to me. He was just doing, you know, following orders just like I was. So.
Hey, Brian, pop up the chat session, the chat log. There's a lot of good questions coming in.
Okay.
You're the one that I think can answer these right now.
Okay. Wow.
Always check the chat logs because you will find great information being shared and great questions being asked needing to be answered. That's why we have it. So.
Do you have an estimate when this book that I already have ordered? Yeah, it's probably going to be the first or second week of December. Wasn't there suspicion on Liggett's ex-wife that he faked his death? Yeah, that's what she said in that video. Did Roscoe's notes suggest that he attacked someone in the grassy knoll? Yes. There is in the diary that was confiscated or stolen by Agent Tom Ferris of the Dallas FBI office. There was, here's what we did. Ricky didn't have the diary, and that's been an area of contention for a lot of folks who don't believe the story was all fake. Let me tell you something. Ricky is not smart enough to put this together. You know, he's not that sophisticated to come up with all this, the cables and the canister and the pictures and all that stuff. But he wrote in the diary, Ricky read it and reread it. He gave it to his wife and they read it so many times. And this is a direct quote, and it burned the words into their brains. And so when Gary and I interviewed him, we put him in separate rooms and said, write it down on a piece of paper, what you remember about the diary, everything you can remember. And they were almost verbatim together. They were almost exactly the same rendition, recollection of what they read in the diary. But there's one section in the diary where it says, he's on the knoll, man in front, blocking view or something like that. I have to go back and read it. But, and then Roscoe wrote world, W-H-I-R-L-E-D, world. I guess that means jumped. World over the fence, took down man on other side of fence to protect myself. Well, in the Darnell film, you'll see, there's a blood spot. There appears to be a spot on the sidewalk going down the steps towards the sidewalk on Elm Street. And, Jerry Foley, who was a reporter for the Dallas Morning News, responded to the assassination after it was over with and saw all these people out on the street, and he started wandering around and he went up to the top of the steps where Robert Groden always had his little table. And he said there was a fresh red spot on the ground. And he looked at it and thought, well, you know, either that's soda pop or, gosh, I hope it's not blood. So he went back to the Dallas Morning News, got a photographer, and we've got his name. We interviewed him. And they both showed up. He took a couple pictures of it. And according to Foley, the photographer dipped his little finger in it and tasted it, and it had been coagulating now. Obviously, it was blood, so the photographer tasted it and said it was blood. Well, they went back. They developed the picture. The photographer developed the picture. Within 2 or 3 hours, two FBI agents show up and said, hey, we understand you saw something over on the steps. Did you take a picture of it? Yeah. Well, we need the picture. You get the photographer, bring the picture and the negatives over. We're going to take those for evidence. And the parting shot was, you boys didn't see this. You don't know anything about it. And this conversation never took place. Well, they went back the next day with Hugh Ainsworth, and the spot has been cleaned up. So I don't think it was Gordon Arnold that was assaulted. I mean, he surely didn't mention that. I mean, that would have been the first thing out of my mouth if I was the guy. You go, yeah, I'm standing there taking pictures, and the next thing I know, I'm getting the crap beat out of me. But if that was blood, where did it come from? Did Roscoe have to beat down somebody to get, you know, to protect himself? I don't know. We don't have any way of knowing who he was talking about. There could have been several people standing there, but Roscoe wrote that in the in his diary. I had to take the man down to protect myself. Now, did he shoot him? Did he knock him in the head? Did he, you know, break his arm? Or did it, something cause somebody to bleed on that sidewalk? So I'm interested to know if anybody could ever figure that out for us. That would really help. But I don't, again, I don't think it was Gordon Arnold, but I think it was somebody that Roscoe had to do to protect himself from getting seen, I guess. William, yeah, William interviewed Cooley. It's Cooley, isn't it? Yeah. And said that he said the same thing. Yeah. He, I mean, there's no reason for him to make up a story like that. It just doesn't make sense. It's not important enough to fake it, but, there's a good picture of it in the Darnell film. If you can stop it on YouTube and you see a big blood spot, there's a man or a woman and her child. They're walking right around it and she's looking down at it like, you know, pulling the kid away. Don't get anywhere near that. That's somebody's blood. William said, wait, Ricky's family said he was lying. Nobody in the family ever said Ricky was lying. I've never heard that. Ricky's never mentioned that. The two half brothers of, the half brother and half sister of Roscoe, Gary interviewed both of them many, many years ago and said that, Roscoe was really into photography. We don't know where he learned it, but, Ricky, you know, Ricky was a self, you know, young man that had no reason to lie about any of that. What's that end of power? Where's, well, let's put it this way. I don't think Gary Shaw would go out on a limb and risk his reputation. And I'm certainly not going to do that either, if I didn't believe the story. And hopefully some of you will get to talk to Ricky in November. He is coming on our panel. He'll be there for the duration of the panel and maybe a little later. But he's just a good old boy. And there's no deceptive bone in his body. He's just trying to get the story out to see if anybody can help him. Go ahead, Brooks. You got a question? Oh, you're on mute, bud.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple of things. You guys know I've always been into the analysis, the mathematical analysis of angles, where a shot could come from, maybe near the underpass, maybe from a storm drain and so on. If you've got a shooter where Badgeman was along the north leg of the fence, that shot is almost perpendicular to JFK.
Right.
So, you know, if he gets hit in the right side of the head somewhere, logic would tell you it's going to blow out the other side of the head. So in the latest three-shot scenario, when you compare Mantic with Horn, Doug has moved that shot to the head well back behind the right ear, almost tangential, slicing off the back part of the skull there. And it's interesting because Hume's also used the word tangential wound. But I think Doug probably did that. I've not talked to him, but I think he probably did that because he realized the problem with the angle too. Also, from that perspective, if you were shooting from there, you've got JFK in your sights. If you miss him slightly, even the right forward part of the skull, or even if you missed the shot, you would have killed Jackie. So when you're aiming that shot, those heads are side by side.
Right.
Which if I'm a shooter, even though the limo is either stopped or going very slow, I would be aiming more to the back part of JFK because I sure as heck don't want to shoot her.
Right.
So it does kind of support what Horn wrote. Now, Bauer said there were four men behind the fence.
Right.
Two over in the Ed Hoffman, S.M. Holland area, right?
Right.
And the other two that were near the end of the north leg, almost where the gated entrance was to the parking area, as you came down that little side part of Elm, there was a sheriff who rented out those parking spaces, right? And there was an actual gate there.
Right.
So they're right in that area. He said they were in uniform, similar to what you would see over at the courthouse. Now, he didn't say necessarily police, but he says they were uniform men. So if that's Roscoe, someone's with him.
Yeah.
And it made me think that I don't think that shot from there was very practical, but what they might have been doing, particularly after Gordon Arnold was chased out of there, that might have come around to the area, and they might have been standing post to make sure that nobody got back in that area.
Right.
You know, to keep people out of the way. So they're definitely part of the plot, right? They're standing post back there. So
right.
That's just a thought that I had.
Well, you know, and I was going through my notes a couple of weeks ago, and I came across two pages that Casey and I had interviewed Ed Hoffman with his daughter present. And obviously Ed Hoffman could not talk. He would sign it. But to his daughter, he said, and I shared this with Gary, and he said, where have you been hiding this? And I want to have to look it up, but I'll post it. Ed said that he saw a policeman behind the fence without a hat, because he could see, and he knew it was a policeman because he saw the badge and the shoulder patch. He said this policeman didn't have a hat on. He said, but a man came around the corner, around the north edge of the east edge of the fence, and spoke to this policeman for just a brief, you know, 15, 20 seconds. And he said the man turned and walked away. And Ed said that the guy that walked up to this policeman had what appeared to be a camera slung around his neck, or the strap, and it looked like a camera. He said the next thing he remembers, that Ed remembers, is a policeman came around the north end of the, or east end of the fence again, but this one had a hat on. He said he couldn't tell if it was the same officer or not. But now we've got Hargis, we've got Beverly Oliver, and now we got Ed Hoffman saying there was a cop and behind the fence. So Gary doesn't believe that the badge man photo, or the badge man part of the Mormon photo, is a legit deal. And I'm on the fence about it. I don't know, but it certainly is a good place for a shot to be fired. And what a great cover to have as, you know, a cop. You could tell people to get out of there and nobody's going to confront you with it. But you're right, Brooks. When we practiced, we had a shooter and a spotter. I was a shooter and I had a spotter. Roscoe's diary says that Roscoe wrote, gave gun to the man to my side who took it to the rail yard. And so that would be a good job for the spotter, not only to keep people away from you when you're pulling the trigger, but also to get rid of evidence. Then you can walk around and not have a gun or a rifle in your hand. But that position is a good use of concealment. But obviously it wasn't concealed very much because the witnesses on the bridge saw smoke. Beverly said there was a guy by a three trunk tree. Gene Hill said there was a guy by the corner of the fence. Gordon Arnold said there was a cop, you know, within seconds knocking him to the ground. You know, he's on the ground and taking his film. Bobby Hargis, you know, all these people are, you know, they couldn't have made all this stuff up, but it's just a matter of trying to plug in which one's the most accurate representation. But that was the way it would have been laid out as far as, you know, good place for the cops to be up there. And Roscoe said after he shot, he said the last line of the events, he says definite hit, target's down. And then he said he left through the railroad, we call it the rail yard, left through the rail yard to my car. His car was parked somewhere close to the west side of the book depository. So there was a lot of activity going back there. But I think Roscoe was there. There's no doubt in my mind he was there. But who was he with? I don't know. Let's see what else.
One other comment. If you look at the Mormon photo, if Horn is correct and that shot hit Kennedy well in the back of the head behind the right ear and basically just cut off that back part of the skull back there, that blowout, the fragments and all that, you can see how Hargis would have got sprayed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And he didn't just get sprayed. He got hit. I mean, the force of the impact, I don't know if I've seen an interview or read some things, but it was a hell of a hit when he got sprayed.
And I remember him saying it almost knocked him off his bike because he wasn't sick from that. It was like a big gust of wind with all that crap on his face and helmet.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know about the badge ban. We didn't cover that in the book because, you know, we can't prove it one way or the other, but it's certainly an interesting, I respected Jack White, not so much Gary Mack, but Jack White's analysis. I don't know. We didn't put it in because we couldn't prove it one way or the other.
Well, if Roscoe's shooting, where's he at?
He could be at the corner of the fence or down by the three trunk tree where Beverly saw him.
Okay, on the west leg then.
Yeah, to the west. Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
But I'm thinking he's a little closer to the corner because the way he wrote his diary was that he shot, definite hit, and then the next thing he wrote was I whirled over the fence, took down a man to protect myself. So I'm thinking he didn't have to run too far to get around the side of the fence. He jumped over. He's probably standing on a bumper because that's the only way he could jump over a fence. You know, that fence is chest over chest high on me. And, you know, there's no way I could climb it and jump over it. So I'm wondering if he was standing on a bumper. But do we know Roscoe was a smoker? Absolutely. And it's a good question, Erica. The question is, do we know if Roscoe was a smoker? He was a heavy smoker. And Ricky confirmed that. He says, got it. Both of them, he and his mom and dad, smoked all the time. In fact, there's a picture in my of Roscoe in the Marines sitting on a bunk. He's got a cigarette in his mouth. He's a big, big smoker right here. Let me share a screen with you again.
Well, to your point, not only were there a lot of cigarette butts
right there,
close to that corner.
Yeah.
There was also mud on the bumper when Holland and that gang got around there. And so if he used the bumper as a way to lift, that could tie to that. But.
Yeah. But yeah, Roscoe was a big smoker. Yeah. In fact, Ricky said he and his brother, Ricky's brother suffered from asthma as a child. I mean, it was almost to the point where they were going to have to put him in an iron lung. He had it so bad. And he said every time mom and dad smoked, he says, oh, I took him outside because it was so bad inside the house. They didn't have air conditioning, so there's no way to get rid of the smoke. It would just hang in the air, and really, it was really bad. So, yeah, I thought when I read that too, when he told me that, I thought, oh, there's the smoke and cigarette butts underneath, you know, on this next to the fence. So, good questions. Thanks. Okay, I'm done, Dave. Thank you.
All right, Brian. Thank you for that enlightening. In rendition of the research and stuff that you guys are working on with the book. Also, I want to do a share screen for those that maybe missed this the last time. You can pre-order The Admitted Assassin. Here's the cover of the book, and it's at Penal Unlimited. I believe that's how you say it. Or there's a QR code you can scan with your phone right now, and you can go right to the address to the address to order the book.
Yeah. It's available now. So, here you go.
All right. Speaking of books, we had a person in our audience. His name, I believe, was Andrew. He reached out by email. I have an idea of doing a spotlight with the with him and the other authors of the book. For the life of me, for the second I can't figure out what the chokeholds, that was it. So I'm going to get a copy of that book and then set up a spotlight presentation to go over that book. But speaking of books, I want to talk to Bart Camp. And everybody is on your bandwagon, Bart. They're getting your book. They're reading it. Me personally, I haven't gotten a copy of it yet. I want to get a copy. I want to start picking it apart. I know, and I apologize. I will get it. I don't know. Don't know when it will happen, but it will happen as soon as I can. But Bart, tell us, you know, give us some information here. I know we were kind of short on time last 2 weeks ago when we had you on. But for those of you that didn't know, Prayer Man, Bart's book is out. So yeah. Bart, take it away.
I haven't planned anything on saying, but I'll do a little chat. I released the book in paperback 3rd of September. It's been going pretty good. Can't complain. I did an ebook before that. And it's about half-half. At certain times it goes two-thirds in the favor of printed copy. The feedback's been really good. The only ones that have been negative were the people that are jealous, and there's a small group. You know, you can't cook for everyone. So you know, the lone nutters are suspiciously quiet. And in all honesty, I basically put the book together in such a way that I don't care about opinions. I defecate on them, and basically it's evidence-based, so there's 1,200 odd sources in there, and I basically stitch it all together by looking at the evidence and putting it in the right time frame, and so it's in three chapters. The first one is about Prayer Man, the second one is about Inside the Texas School Book Depository, and the third one is about Oswald's interrogations. Oswald's interrogations is the biggest chapter of all three. It's, I think it covers more than half of the book, and it's all in the chronology. And I did that based on the documentation, pictures, videos, and so forth, put all that together. And then, with the Texas School Book Depository as well, I looked at all the people inside the Texas School Book Depository, and there's quite a few. Two on the first floor, two on the second, five on the third, at the top of my head, 10 on the fourth, is my opinion, and on the fifth were four people. The people from the fifth floor, they're, in a nutshell, their statements don't rhyme at all. And if you look at all the statements, then there's one thing that is a massive cause of avoidance. I mean, besides the whole Victoria Adams Sandra Stiles thing that Barry Ernest already wrote about in great detail, but what he didn't look into much was the how many women were actually on the fourth floor. And officially there were 8, but I say there were 10 because two people claimed they were on the front steps, and they cannot be identified or seen at any point, nor is anyone basically say, like, yeah, I saw those two girls. And what's more interesting is the fact that you have Avery Davis and you have Judith McCulley. And Judith McCulley's first FBI statement basically said that she was on the fourth floor. But because Avery Davis said she was on the stairs, the FBI made her change her affidavit from the fourth floor to the front stairs. Now, if you look at the statements from the fifth floor guys, the fourth floor women, and the third floor women, all of them looked out from the west windows down to see what was happening there. And everything is a smoke and mirrors exercise. Like, the women on the third floor never heard the shots, which is really strange, you know, considering that on the first, second, also the third floor southwest window, southeast window, there was a guy standing there. His name is just escaping me, who heard the shots. But on the west side, they couldn't hear it, apparently. All three of them said that. On the fourth floor, the women went to the west window to look out. And the boys from the fifth floor, they went actually first looked out themselves on the fifth floor and then went downstairs the floor and had a chat. If you look at the statements, that goes from, yeah, we went there and we had a chat, to like, no, we didn't stop doing the warning course. No, we didn't stop. We went down right away. And then, of course, Prayer Man, like the title already says, it's more than the fuzzy picture. It's about the evidence that basically points to Oswald being outside, and there is some. And there's indirect evidence as well, circumstantial stuff. I haven't been to Dallas yet. I'm going next year at some point. And I hope to interview a few people to get some more information. There's going to be a special edition. What that means is that I've already got two bits that I'm going to add on. And there's also hopefully the interviews. And then on top of that, some of the pictures and documentations are going to be printed inside the book. You just need to find out what pictures are going to look at while being printed on Amazon and all that la-di-da. So that's something that needs to be checked out and discovered what the quality is going to be like, because it needs to be good quality. And on top of that, I've been really busy with the Blonde Archives, and especially in the last month. Did a lot, and there's more coming, but I'm almost finished, so that's a good thing. And then it's going to get released, I don't know, first quarter next year, hopefully. And released in the sense that it's going to be updated. It's going to be about 20, about almost 30,000 pages extra. And we're looking at another archive coming out from Matthew Smith. And then on top of that, I'm basically looking into another book, maybe two. And the first book is going to be about specific aspects, photographic aspects of the Kennedy assassination. So let's see, the cameras from the Mexico City, from the Russian embassy, the Nixon film, Zapruder. I'm not going to yap about Zapruder till the cows come home. I'm only talking about specific aspects of it. I'm going to refer to all the other research before. I'm not going to rehash all that. And what else have I got here? James Powell, The Limo, Mary Mormon. I want to investigate Alpha 66 in Dallas. I've got two pictures of that particular meeting. Then the Minox backyard photos. And the biggest one is the evidence photos. And that's basically the Dallas police and the FBI that took evidence photos. Doesn't rhyme at all. The Dallas police photos and the FBI. A lot of things disappeared. Conveniently. And with the book, the Prayer Man thing, for me, the film, the Darnell film, or the Wiegman film, a good quality copy would be icing on the cake. We were very close. Ed Ledoux and I managed to find a copy of Wiegman, sorry. We got a 5K copy. But it was a newsreel, and I would really need to talk to somebody about duplication of films in those days, because I put two pictures next to each other. One was from that reel, and one is from the Richard E. Sprague collection at NARA, and I took the same shot and I basically put them next to each other, and the difference in processing and quality is unreal. And in the sense that the 5K is worse quality than the Richard E. Sprague shot. So we were quite pissed off at that. And Darnell, well, it's at the 6th Floor Museum, but I've been told that the reading room is closed at this point. Staff cutbacks and all that malarkey. And so there's still stuff to be investigated. NBC New York, all that malarkey. And we'll see how it goes. But for me, it isn't that important. I think the paperwork that came with the interrogations from Hostie and Fritz, and from Hostie, not just his flipbook notes, but also his pre-report and his typed-up report, co-report with James Bookout, is more telling than the footage. Because even though I'm a photographer, and even though I recognize Oswald in those films, that's not 100% guarantee until you get it really properly done. And if I do get the copy of the film in an high resolution, it will need artificial intelligence for deblurring to figure that out. But that would be, like I said, it's the cherry on top, the icing on the cake, basically. So for that, we'll see how that goes. It's not a priority for me. The reason why I'm doing the other book, I'm just going to start looking into that next year with all the other photography elements in it, is because I've got a lot of shit hot documentation from the Blunt archives that no one's ever seen or used before. So that makes it interesting, and that made me also do the book, because I know there's a lot of, it's quite an exclusive element to it, pretty big as such. I just see a question pop up here. If Oswald was getting a Coke in the second floor lunchroom during the assassination, what can we say about his level of knowledge, interest in the presidential motorcade outside the building? Absolutely nothing, because the second floor lunchroom encounter didn't happen. It's completely debunked. I know this is a really sore matter to discuss for conspiracy theorists and lone nutters together, because that's like they have an area of contention that the second floor lunchroom encounter happened, and I'll tell you, it's the biggest load of guff that ever happened. And in my book, I precisely point out where and how it is basically was put together as such. And in a nutshell, in his first interrogation, Hostie and Buchhout join at 3:50. Now, the exact time when Fritz starts to interrogate Oswald is not known. It is either 3 o'clock or maybe 2:45. And from the notes that Hostie was the only one took, it becomes evident that he was outside, standing outside, watching the presidential parade. And on top of that, he got a Coke for his lunch. There is absolutely no talk about an encounter. There's no talk about him getting a Coke after the shooting as such. The whole thing is invented pretty quick by the FBI when Nat Pinkston gets a phone call while he's in the Texas School Book Depository and does an interview with Roy Truly. And this is when the whole thing is concocted. And there are 3 or 4 statements from Truly within 24 hours, basically lining it all out about the second floor lunchroom encounter as such. If you look at Marion Baker's first statement as well, there's no mention of an encounter. The only encounter that he did was on the 3rd or the 4th floor. So the whole thing basically gets concocted together in 24 hours after, and it's no different than with the rifle. In my book, I point out really precisely that when Oswald was allegedly arraigned for the murder of the president by about 1:30 in the morning on the 23rd, there was no evidence to tie him to the rifle. The Heidel ID didn't exist on November the 22nd. Again, I come out with several instances of evidence that points out that that the Heidel ID didn't exist at all. That the Heidel name and the Heidel rifle order, isn't found until early in the morning, like 7:30 in the morning on the 23rd, and that the Heidel ID isn't brought up until the 4th interrogation, which is Saturday the 23rd, by about 11:30 in the morning. Before that, there are 3 interrogations, and there's not one mention whatsoever on that whole Heidel ID whatsoever. If you're looking at William Westbrook and Robert Barrett, all that quack afterwards about the Heidel ID, that they find it in the wallet and so forth, complete rubbish, because if you look at their official reports, once again, no mention about any Heidel whatsoever. There's lots more in the book, so buy the book. Over to you, David.
I appreciate that, Bart, and definitely, get his book. I will be and be checking that out. We've had David Denton stop by. Thank you, David, for showing up. He's going to chime in and give us a few details on the conference that is coming up in right at 2 weeks. Less than 2 weeks, we'll be having the conference. And also, our event that will be happening on Tuesday, November 21st at 6 p.m. So, Dave, go ahead and unmute yourself and give us some details. Nope, you're still muted.
Can you hear me now?
No, I got you, Dave. Go ahead.
Yeah, good. Well, thanks for having me on, Dave. I don't have a whole lot of time here, but I want to take the opportunity to invite, again, we got a couple things really important coming up. I'm sure Dave's spoken some a little bit today, but we're less than 2 weeks out for our big event in Dallas, and we've got a great turnout. We're looking to possibly have full capacity, but before it's said and done with at the hotel, which is a lot of new folks showing up, a lot of folks we haven't seen before sign up for the concert. I think that speaks to the added interest, I believe, in the case. It's an opportunity to look at things, expose things. We have a great lineup of speakers. I invite everybody to take another look on JFK Historical Group for our lineup. And, you know, if you can't make it in person, we also are looking at, you know, our Zoom. We're pushing that right now, and we encourage folks to look at the event in terms of Zoom as well. And even if you're, you know, we're not the only game in town, or actually in the country, and obviously some people might be attending some other events, but you might want to check out ours too, even if you're at another event. And then Dave mentioned an additional thing. Since our conference ends is basically on Sunday, you know, a lot of these conferences are difficult to do if the anniversary lands in the middle of the week, right before Thanksgiving. That makes it pretty impossible to have an event at that time. But on November 21st, the evening before, we're having an event at my college, Ollie Central College. We're starting, I believe, at 6 o'clock. We're going to do that on Zoom. It's going to be, you know, a little bit of a, you know, a overview of the events in Dallas that year. It's also the 60th anniversary of the beginning of our college, so we kind of merged those things. And we just felt like, you know, I'll have a live audience and students there, but also we're going to do Zoom, and then the Project JFK guys are going to jump in and give some presentations and maybe have an opportunity to kind of wrap up or give some summation to some of the things that happened over the weekend with our conference. So we encourage you to look at both events. Again, Dave, I'm a little short on time here. I can't stick out around for long, but does anybody have any quick questions about what we got coming up? I know Dave's well informed about the event as well, or the events.
Yeah, I don't think if anybody wants to have a question asked, now is the time. I know Dave's short on time, like you said, or I can answer to the best of my availability. And if I don't have the answer, I will get it from Dave. But we've been working pretty good on getting this event in Dallas and the virtual part taken care of. And also, this is an opportunity that we have not done the eve or the day of the assassination anniversary. So I'm pretty excited to have that event. Like I say, Dave just said he's going to be doing it live in person at Olney Central College, and then of course it'll be live. And then the Project JFK guys, me, Brian, and Casey, will be taking part. So you might want to tune in. If you don't get a chance to attend the event, you might hear some details that will, you know, be exposed of what took place down in Dallas. Let's see. You got a question here. For those who can't do the Zoom, will the conference be available for a fee to see later? Yes. It will not be done through Zoom in a future, you know, pay and watch later. But the digital files will be uploaded. You can purchase them from ProjectJFK.com, or you can order a flash drive and have it sent through snail mail, whichever you prefer. Let's see here. Next question we've got. What are the topics of discussion by the keynote speakers during the two lunches and banquet dinner? Let me pull up the schedule here real quick and see what we've got in the banquet. And let's see here. Give me just a quick sec. We go over to the JFK Historical website, click on conference, and it looks like Friday is going to be our first luncheon. That's going to be Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, the deep answers to JFK assassinations, are hidden in the mystical at Fitzgerald revelations. That's going to be Friday's topic during the lunch. Saturday is going to be a luncheon featuring Dick Russell, new revelations from the Rob Reiner, Selene O'Brien podcast series for those who signed up. And then our banquet, is going to be Saturday evening. That's going to be, let's see, the JFK, marking the 60th, the JFK assassination's place in history, why it's still important, featuring myself, Ed Tatro, and David Denton. So in answer to that question, what we're going to have for the lineup, for the lunches and the dinner, you'll definitely want to take part in that. These are some great keynote speakers. Dick Russell, I have not seen him in a conference, per se, since we did a virtual event back during COVID. But he'll be live in person at our event. So you'll want to buy your lunch tickets, banquet tickets, and if you can support us by attending all of them, we'd love to have you support us that way. If not, you want to pick and choose, we do have the a la carte option. If you're on Zoom, and you're not in person, on Zoom, you will see the lunches and the dinner banquet speakers. Once we turn on the cameras at the conference, they roll until we close for the day. Even when we take breaks, the cameras are still on. We're just, you know, on break at that time. But you will see it at home if you purchase that Zoom ticket. If you're in person, it's only if you purchase a ticket will you be in the room. Otherwise, we clear the room out and we let people get their food and come back in. So you don't want to miss out on keynote speakers without buying your lunch or your banquet tickets. Anybody else have any questions about our conference that's coming up in 2 weeks or our 21st, evening of the 21st event? And remember, guys, towards the end of that November 21st evening, I know it's on a Tuesday, which is kind of weird. We usually do our journey meetings on Saturdays. But towards the evening after Dave gets done with his stuff at Olney, then we'll have our presentation. I know Casey's going to do a presentation. Brian's going to do some talk on Roscoe White more in depth and the book. And then I'm going to be doing a remembrance of that weekend, the assassination, why it's still important to, you know, get the younger generation involved, to keep seeking the truth and to keep finding, you know, the answers and demanding the answers from the government. And then we'll open it up to a roundtable discussion between everybody that's in attendance that evening. You can share stories. You can ask questions. And it's a great event to attend to. Those tickets are live. There's a 100-seat capacity as of right now if we get more. And, hell, I'm hoping we have more people show up that evening. But right now there's a limit of 100 tickets online, so hurry up and sign up now if you can. And then we can always add in more seats later on. Dave, I know you're a busy guy, so unless you have anything else to add, I'll move on.
Well, thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me this afternoon, and we look forward to seeing as many folks possible at both those events, and it's getting close. Thank you very much, okay?
All right, thanks, Dave.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, we're going to take a pause for, I don't want to say station identification, but show identification. You are watching Project JFK CSI Dallas Presents The Journey, the November 4th, 2023 meeting. And if you guys like what we're doing, obviously we have a website. You can subscribe to that to be on the mailing list when we make updates to the website. You can subscribe and like our videos on YouTube. The easiest way to find YouTube, because it is listed underneath my name, you can search it that way, or David Knight, Project JFK. You can also just click on one of the videos on our website and then go to where it says YouTube. You'll click on that and you can find our videos. We are going to be releasing 34 hours of film footage out of our vaults. That will be happening either the end of this month or sometime in December, but they are coming out. So when you guys see those videos, hey, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button. And not only do we have a PayPal donate button, but so does David Denton's JFK Historical Group. And if you like what we're doing, if you like what he's doing and his group, we're working in conjunction here, guys. So if you like what we're doing, you know, hit the subscribe, hit the donate if you can, and help us keep the lights on, help us keep events coming up for, you know, future endeavors. Speaking of future endeavors, I am I've spoke about this before. I'm going to speak about it again. I am looking at doing an event in Overland Park, Kansas. This will be spring of next year, 2024. It'll be held at the college campus that I attend at Johnson County Community College. I am still working out the details, trying to get funding for that, where we'll rent the conference room for a Friday and a Saturday. And we're going to have not only Project JFK in attendance, Casey, Brian, and myself. We'll have David Denton there. And I'm hoping to get some more speakers lined up as we get through the Dallas conference. That's our main, that's my main stay right now, what I've got to get finished. But we're looking probably the end of April, 1st of May for that event. More details will be coming soon, not only here on the Journey shows, but also on the website. And I know we had to cancel our Kansas City conference back when we had COVID running rampant. So this will be a chance to come to, you know, the state of Kansas. We're kind of right here in the center in the Midwest. And, you know, it's not Dallas, but, hey, guess what? It's a new venue, and hopefully we can get some new students involved. And when I say students at community college, you have anywhere from 18 to 80. So it's great to get new generations and new researchers involved in this. And in order to get that is getting our speakers and our current researchers and generation researchers that take part here in the Journey meeting to come out and speak to these students. This will be a student symposium, that we haven't had in Kansas in, you know, quite some time. So I'm looking forward to that event. I'm excited about putting it together and bringing it to you. And of course, obviously we'll have it in person. And if I can get Zoom lined up as well, then we will have Zoom capabilities. And again, that's, like I say, spring of 2024. More details on that will be coming soon. Right now I am going to open it up. I mean, I don't have anything else on my schedule. So would anybody like to ask questions? Do you have some research that you're working on right now that you want to share with us? Or do you just want to talk about some tidbits of the JFK assassination as a whole? I'm going to open it up to whoever wants to, you know, unmute yourself and step into the conversation. Everybody's welcome.
Not all at once.
Yeah, not all at once. Thank you, Bart. And speaking of Bart, that I was just talking about in the spring of next year, I don't know when you're coming to Dallas. We're about, well, a plane flight is pretty damn quick. A car ride is about 9 hours away. But if I could have, I'd love to have you be able to talk to the students and to everybody in the research community, whether it's in person or on Zoom. So I want to get with you between now and spring. I'd love to have you as a guest speaker.
I will keep that in mind. If I go, I intend to go to Dallas for a week and Washington for a week because I want to experience the utter frustration of NARA. And I probably won't last a week. I'll probably walk out the door there within 2 days. So see, Malcolm is a very patient person, and he tells me about this stuff, and I'm like, and he told me that Harry Livingston used to come a few times as well, but he always walked out as well, couldn't deal with it. And a friend of mine, Terry Martin, went there for me a couple of times back in 2016, and every time he walked out, he was crock off, like the rest you can imagine. So I want to do that, and I want to do Dallas, but if I can combine it, then yeah, sure, it's not a problem. I will come and do a talk.
Well, that would be great, Bart. And hey, we're right. I mean, if you're in Dallas and you need to fly to Washington or vice versa, you can always stop at in Kansas City. You know, we're right in between the two. So that would be, if we can work it out, that would be awesome. I'd love to have you.
All right. I'll keep that, definitely keep that in mind.
All right. Perfect. Let's see here. We had a question that popped up. This is from Mike. To all, why was the null shot a boom while all the other are silenced firecracker sounds? Let me add in my sound here. The silenced firecracker sound, looking at the fact that Oswald was not a shooter, the shot did not come from the 6.5 Carcano. When I look at doing my research on the throat shot, I come in with the AR-5 and AR-7 sound, which sounds like a firecracker. Now, of course, if you haven't seen my presentation on that, I have it available. It's in our Blueprint for Murder book. It's also available either in print or on digital, but it will explain, at least for the throat shot, that matches up to the size of the entrance hole and also the sound of the firecracker going off acoustically, that matches compared to the boom that you asked in your question as far as from the grassy knoll, if it came from the grassy knoll. And which grassy knoll? Was it the north or was it the south knoll? Very good question. Would anybody else like to add something into that of the sound that Mike is asking about? Let's see. Here's a question for Bart from PM. I'm guessing that's Patrick, right?
No.
Oh, different PM? Okay, I just
yes.
PM. I went with Patrick McCarthy. But did any official ever challenge the black witnesses on the fifth floor about the fact that they heard these explosive sounds via the plaster boards but no footsteps above them? Bart?
That's a good question. And that's exactly, I bring that up in the book, exactly that point. They heard the shots and they heard the shells drop and blah, 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 but they never heard the footsteps. Whereas, one of the women on the fourth floor heard footsteps going over them. And also from the third floor, somebody who sat on the toilet heard footsteps as well. So yeah, it's really strange that because the boards were really thin, there was no insulation in between those two floors from fifth and sixth, and you know, the dust was falling through the cracks as such, as they said. So yeah, it's really weird. I mean, I say something that is going to rock the boat a little, but I'm almost leaning towards the fact that maybe one shot was fired from the sixth floor, if that. I think Daltex building is much better candidate for the shooter to go shoot behind a limousine. There are some really good shots by Shell Hairston, which are on the prayer man side in the galleries. And if you're looking at the view, they mounted a rifle on, I don't know, the fourth or the fifth floor or something like that of the Daltex building. And it looks out down Elm, and it's just absolutely perfect for shooting anyone on going down that street, not from the sixth floor. You know what I've got a problem with the sixth floor sniper's nest are those two pipes, those heating pipes that are right next to the window. So if you're a right-hand shooter, right, you've got those pipes, and they prevent you from leaning in as such. And otherwise, you would have to lean out the window, you know, and it just doesn't work. I mean, I'm a lefty shoot-wise. And so for me, it would be easier. But for a right-handed shooter, it would be a nightmare. And those pipes, I mean, if you look at the picture, there's a picture on the Sixth Floor Museum website that Spalding Jones took, and it's in color. And there's like an FBI agent with a phone in that sniper's nest. And you can just see these pipes, and on the Warren Commission exhibits as well. And every time I look at those pipes and I go, they're in the way. They're absolutely in the way. So, yeah, do you have it by any chance? And that's just, you know, just, I don't know. For a right-handed shooter, it's nothing short of cumbersome.
Looks like Brian's trying to find it here. Let's see if he can.
That'd be cool.
Well, if I can comment on that.
I can add a quick comment on that.
All right.
Go for it.
Yeah. When you read Geneva Hines' testimony, she went over to the window on the second floor office area over on looking out on the Houston. So she sat at the window facing the Dow Techs, turned and looked up, looking south on Houston.
Yeah.
You know, you can see the windows there on the right in this picture.
Yeah.
So she would be just out of view, I think another window, maybe two windows down, on the second floor. And she said the three shots, I think the terminology, just like a loud, like almost, I think she might even use the word cannon, just incredibly loud boom, all three shots. Now, if those were fired from the third floor away from the building towards the underpass, it's going away from, never would have sounded anything like that. So what she's hearing are shots from the Dow Techs reverberating back and forth between the two buildings. And it just had to be an incredible sound if what she's saying is true.
There's a great video of Patricia Ann Donaldson interviewed by Max Holland. Okay. And this is so fantastic because she stands in front of the Texas School Book Depository. And then she goes, yeah, then the shots came, and she's pointing to the Hall Tax building where the shots have come from and such. And Holland just sits there nodding like, yeah, it's just behind you. No, it's to the left, mate. It's right there. And in the Beekman film, there's a shot of Linda Giovanna Zambanini used to refer to as the Trulli group. It's a group where employees of the second and the third floor were, and also Roy Trulli and Aucus Campbell were standing. And in that shot, there's a shot that Carolyn Arnold and a lady who's shorter, and they both look towards the Dahl Tech building while the shots are basically being fired as such. Now, if you look into Dahl Tech, and this is something like that really needs to be investigated. It hasn't been done properly. But if you look at Dahl Tech and the companies that were in there and the people that were in there, it is 10 times more nefarious than whatever supposedly happened in the Texas School Book Depository as such. Right, my two cents.
Well, thank you, Bart. We've got the what I was just talking about a while ago with the we've got a question here from McNemus. Are we thinking the throat shot was from the Grassy Knoll shooter, or was it from another location such as the Triple Overpass or the south side of Elm Street, the result of the bullet hole through the front windshield? I'm going to do a screen share here real quick. This is, of course, my theory, but, you know, I opened up to I'm not 100% on, you know, I'm up to negotiations on it. I'm not saying this is exactly what happened. I'm just going back to physical evidence and to ballistics itself. Let's see here. When I go back and look at the Tom Dillard photo, the uncropped version, I see something on the bridge. When I clean it up and look at, it's a little bit easier to see. The grain is, you know, it's a little more in focus that way. And then when I focus in, I see something on the bridge. Could this be a shooter? It's possible. This could be a shooter. Seconds after this photograph was taken, it was the, not Dillard. It was, Cancellari. In the Cancellari photo, this figure is gone. Could we be seeing a shooter on the Triple Overpass that would have caused, and what I feel could be the, you know, front throat shot in a tactical shooting position? When you look at from the, if you look over the, this is the area standing on top, looking at the edge of the bridge, when you're crouched down in a shooting position, you have a perfect straight through shot at the car coming right at you. If you put a scope on the rifle, you have a perfect shot going through the windshield. Was I saying he was trying to go through the windshield? Hell no. I think the fact of it was he misjudged where the bullet was going to drop, and it went through the windshield. I think it was AR-5 rifle, and I talk about General Curtis LeMay keeping his AR-5. He's the one who procured this for the United States Air Force. And when he died, they found this rifle in his personal belongings. He took it home with him after he was discharged from the service, after he left. How do we know it was his? It's got his damn, it's got a sticker right here, right above the magazine discharge, and it's got his signature on that decal. It's just a theory, but it's the closest thing that I've come to figuring out where a front shooter could be and have a photographic evidence to back it up with. And also, the bullet itself out of the AR-5, the 22 Hornet, lines up with the size of the throat wound. Now, I'm going to hear a detractor say, well, they didn't know what the hell the size of the throat wound was because they did a tracheotomy. The doctors saw the hole in the throat before the tracheotomy was performed. They said it was the size of a number 2 pencil. If you look at the size and diameter of a 6.5 Carcano round, which, if you understand Spectre's idea of being the magic bullet, it came in, hit him in the back, exited his throat. Well, that's bullshit, in my opinion. But, again, it's my opinion. I think it was a front shot. If you look at the hole in the windshield idea, some people say, oh, there's a hole in the windshield. I just read something the other day. No, there was no hole in the windshield. It was just a crack. Well, how the hell did it get there? You know, when the car pulled up to Parkland Hospital, there was eyewitnesses that stated there was a perfect round hole in the windshield. You could have put a number 2 pencil through it. The car didn't have that hole in the windshield, as far as we know, before it entered Dealey Plaza. So I think a bullet made that hole. It is in my research, it lines up with the throat shot. When I look at going down there and actually looking at where that position is in the Dillard photo, I could make that shot. I think most people could make that shot, and especially if you put a scope on it, you could make that shot.
Dave, can I say something real quick?
Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, the Newcomb tapes where we have Stavis Ellis and Harry Freeman, who saw the hole in the windshield, described it exactly the same way that you did right now, and these are guys that were interviewed and... In fact, I'm going back to this in a couple of weeks because the Newcomb tapes, for some reason, continue to be ignored. And these are the police officers that never went before the Warren Commission. Some died very young, okay? But I confirmed with Douglas Jackson's son, with whom I had contact and who I interviewed several times, that the voice on that tape is his father, all right? So it validates and confirms that the Newcomb tapes are genuine. Bobby Hargis, okay, if you listen to the tapes of Bobby Hargis, you will see that that is Bobby Hargis, if you compare with other recordings of his voice. So for some reason, a lot of things that happened there on Elm Street that were suppressed by the Warren Commission because, and this goes back to the crux of the matter here, you know, if you have only Bobby Hargis and BJ Martin testifying 7.5 pages of Warren Commission testimony, and then Cheney and Jackson are never called, and then you have this clown, you know, Marion Baker, who I heard and I've read somewhere he had an IQ of probably, you know, maybe in the 80s, you know, because that dumb. I'm serious. So the Newcomb tapes need to be accepted as what really happened. And one of the things that they confirmed was the hole in the windshield that was a round, wasn't a crack, it was a round. You could put a pencil through it, and that's exactly what they said. So, we're going to go back to that in a couple of weeks. And it's going to be a lot of fun.
I'm sorry, Baker was called Mama Son. That's what, that's what his nickname was.
You know, the reason they had him way in the back was because he was done.
Yeah.
You know? And you go and look at there's a written, statement by him where you can see that a lot of things that were put in there were not from him, from his own volition. And like you said before, the statements and everything about him, you know, why you, they dedicated 29 pages of Warren Commission testimony and not a single page to Cheney and Jackson. All right. And we know that Jackson was a no writer and, a lot of other things that he witnessed five or six agents dismount from the Queen Mary and surround the limousine with long arms. He said long arms of some kind, you know? And one of the things that just is going to blow you away, he says it, look, that Z film that you sent me, because that's what Newcomb did. He obtained a bootleg copy of the Z film and he sent them to all the motorcycle cops. And then he did follow-up interviews. And that's exactly what Douglas Jackson said, you know. And Douglas Jackson said, look, the way that film that you sent me, it's been cut up. It's been edited. All right? Now, need I say more? Of course not. Hand it over to you.
What's up? Thank you, Larry. What's up on the screen? These are statements from, let's see, we've got Dr. Vela Glanges, George Whitaker Sr., Dallas Motorcycle Patrolman Stavis Ellis, H.R. Freeman, and Secret Service Agent Charles Taylor Jr. They all make reference to the hole in the windshield. These are statements that they put out there. They saw the hole in the windshield. Obviously, like I say, I couldn't find anything in my research that stated the fact that, you know, the car arrived in Dallas and there was already a hole in the damn windshield. First off, I don't think that they would have, you know, put the car out there if it wasn't with a solid windscreen. That's what they called it, windscreen, windshield, whatever you want to call it. So they sure as hell wouldn't have put it out on a motorcade parade with a hole in the windshield. That would have, I don't know, that would have brought up a lot of questions. Now, of course, that windshield, as soon as the assassination's over with, that windshield's taken, the car's taken, driven back, the windshield's been replaced. Where's the windshield at now? Well, the damn thing got destroyed. We can't look at the hole in the windshield. The other thing, the AR-5 and AR-7 sounds like a firecracker. If you put this on a acoustic analyzing, it is within, and I'd have to look at my notes. I don't have them up on the screen at the moment, but as far as closeness to the sound of a firecracker, and the AR-5 and the AR-7 round, it's like 0.06 decibels difference. The 6.5 Carcano, and hell, there's a list of witnesses that said what they heard sounded like a firecracker. You've got 50 ear witnesses. Now, ear witnesses are the same thing as an eyewitness, but these are the ones that are go by an ear witness. They heard what sounded like a firecracker. We don't have photographs of somebody out there like M80s or, you know, Ladyfingers or anything, black cats. You know, we have gunshots going out. Well, what the hell kind of gun sounds like a firecracker? Even if it was a silencer or a suppressor, depending on which term you want to use, they don't sound like a firecracker. Yeah, the doctors at Bethesda, there's this is what they described as a perfect round hole compared to the 3-inch gash that, so this would be what Parkland saw before they did the tracheotomy. After the tracheotomy, the body shows up at Bethesda with a 3-inch gash. I personally think that with the reason why there was a gash there, number one, tracheotomy was performed, but if you go back and look at the interview with Charles Crenshaw, he said that the hole wouldn't have been this big. If you look at an AR-5 with a 22 Hornet or an AR-7 with a 22 long rifle, 22 Magnum, they leave bullet fragments. The best I can describe is why this wound looks like this. They were going in there trying to pull out any bullet fragments that they could to match up to a 22 round. They basically kind of just went in there and did a fishing expedition in the throat and down into the chest cavity, whether it was with forceps, whether it was by hand. If there was anything that they could find, they had to get that shit out of there before it showed up on, you know, an x-ray. But the magic bullet theory, with the wound coming in from the back, going up through the throat, I just call it bullshit. It's that simple. And if anybody, you know, I know Brooks and me, we've had some discussions as far as trajectories go, and I respect Brooks. I like him. I like sitting down and talking about it. You know, if I'm incorrect, that's great. I will take the fact that, hey, I'm incorrect about something. But show me another rifle or another gun that can pull off this shot from that location where we know damn good well somebody had to be there. And what it would look like.
Let me jump in, David. Let me make a quick comment. I do totally agree with what you just said about opening up the throat. I think the reason that was done is they were in there digging around and trying to get some fragments and whatnot. I think there's no doubt about that. Round hole, clean, pristine, entry wound. I was on the phone the other night with Rick Russo. We were on for a couple hours in the middle of the night, talking about forensics and a lot of stuff, and we came around to this topic, and we both arrived at the same conclusion independent of one another, okay? We think the throat shot came from the SM Holland position along the west leg of the fence where the cigarette butts were and whatnot. It's a perfect, and if you look at Willis 5, and that shot, clear, unobstructed view, at JFK, and the bullet path through the front of the neck, ripping out the very side of the trachea, the path through clipping one of the vertebrae, which if we had the neck x-ray, we would see that. It all ties to that position. Both of us believe that Black Dog Man is actually an artifact that's hiding Gordon Arnold. And if you know Gordon Arnold's story, right, that bullet whizzed right past his head, his shoulder, and he hit the deck after that first shot. And then there were subsequent shots fired. So I think that's what you see in Willis 5. And the fact that it's a clear shot at JFK, you don't have to deal with the windshield, you don't have to deal with anybody. I mean, in fact, the opening, as I recall, is between Umbrella Man and the what's his name, the guy in the beret there. There's a gap there when you see in Willis 5. It's a perfect shot. Piece of cake, and distance-wise, it's probably about half of what it would be from the triple underpass. So, anyway, that's kind of our joint opinion on that.
Let me I'm going to show a quick photograph. This was taken in 2019. Me and Brian went down to Dallas.
Thank you very much.
We were down there to – well, actually, we went down to see Gary Shaw. And we also did some work at the we've been down there so many times. I don't know if this was when we saw Gary or if it was when we went to the Dallas Public Library and scanned a bunch of documents and photographs. What you see in the Tom Diller photo, I reenacted. Same spot. And the other one is so grainy. The quality that I shot this photograph in, if you go back, if I can do a side-by-side comparison between Diller's photo, hold on just a second. Let me pull this up. Let's see. Let me go back to the Diller photo for a second, because I like seeing them side by side. Hang on just a second. Bear with me. Of course I had to close the damn window.
While you're digging around, I think the great debate over the hole in the windshield, number one, is it back to front or front to back, right?
Right.
And a lot of people are saying, no, it definitely was front to back. That in itself is hugely problematic, right? Because the only shooter is behind JFK in the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. So they got to make that disappear. And even if it was back to front, unless it's a big fragment, creating a rather clean hole, you have a problem with it. There's only three shots fired.
Right.
You know, so the possible explanation of that would be it went through the windshield and then it went down, it deflected and then it went down and hit the curb and then
what we're seeing on the screen here, this is a Diller photo enlarged. This is the best quality that I've got going in and zooming in on an old photograph. So inside the white circle, you see something there. Now, let's go over here and look at the reenactment photo that me and Brian did. And let me see if I can zoom in on this damn thing. When you see the white that shows up in the photograph, that's a reflection of the hand holding the rifle barrel. It's in the exact same location as what was in the Diller photograph. Obviously, this was taken at a different, this would have been taken in the morning. This was before 12 o'clock, so the sun's in a different location. The sun would actually be more overhead, shining down on this, which makes it, you know, more blurry. Plus, not only that, just look at the age of the photograph in 63 compared to what we have in 2019. But that's me taking aim at an imaginary, well, my target was actually Brian standing where the limousine was at. So could that be a shooter in that location? I think it is. I think that's the spot where we could get a front shot, especially in the throat. Erica, you've got your hand up. Did you want to ask a question?
Yeah, specific to that, because that's great. So try to make it a quickish two-part question. So it makes obviously the most sense that there's obviously multiple teams, which I think we're probably all in agreement on, you know, obviously, you know, probably three or four different positions-ish, stockyard, probably somewhere on the overpass or underpass, whatever, Deltex, and maybe somebody shooting either a blank or something from textbooks, the TSBD, just to make something happen from there, whatever. And obviously this is all for debate, and maybe there's someone in the sewer, blah, 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 who knows. But presuming that I'm in agreement with you, David, for whatever it's worth, me as an amateur, I agree that there's got to be somebody there. It doesn't make any sense if you're a real shooter to not want to have your target coming right at you, you know, coming down, you know, Elm Street. It makes perfect sense to be there. But let's say that person's either a spotter, signaler, or a shooter from that picture that you just showed of your reenactment at that spot. Has there been research, and I haven't seen it, very likely, to identify everybody who's up there on the overpass with SM Holland? I think he said he had three guys with them, and I think he said he had two cops. So in that photo, the original photo, there's like six or seven people there, right? Has someone been able to identify, or more than six, seven, I guess, ten, in the same way like that Bart, you've done, you know, the people on the steps? Has somebody identified everybody who's up there on the overpass before?
I want to throw this in real quick before Bart answers. Can we kind of look and see where I have this in the book, but look at each person on the bridge. Where are their faces at and where is their line of sight at? They're all looking down into Dealey Plaza. The one thing that I got kickback on from a couple people until I showed them this was, okay, this bridge goes all the way across. There's not, you know, this part over here is straight on, okay? It doesn't curve back or anything like that. This son of a bitch is hiding in plain sight. Nobody is paying attention to whoever's crouched down here in the I'm tying my shoe position or a tactical shooting position, every one of them is looking in this location. Everybody that's down here on the street, this guy here, I would basically take his line of sight of looking directly at the car, but everybody's looking behind them or everybody's looking directly in front of them straight down at the street. Nobody is paying attention to this over here on the side. Nobody.
I'll just jump in with my other second part of the question because it really speaks perfectly to this before you hand it off to obviously all these experts here. So precisely what you're saying, right? Like there's no blockage from that side of the overpass bridge to the other people that are standing there. So thinking out loud a little bit, again, if you've got obviously dark complexed man who clearly has a radio or something, let's say you've got somebody on top of the courthouse or whatever, the highest point in Dealey Plaza or whatever, who's got the bird's eye view, who's communicating on radios and all this kind of stuff, right? You've got some spotters along with the shooters. Maybe that person is a spotter and there's a shooter who's right beneath them, right? Because you have all of those alcoves in that, you know, the roadway commerce or whatever that is in commerce, right? On that far end or whatever. So that could also be the shooter and they're their spotter who's above ground, like you said, you know, pretending they're tying their shoe, whatever. All speculation, I know. But if that's, I'm just remembering Holland's, you know, Mark Lane tapes or whatever, essentially saying that he remembered a couple of policemen up there with him on the bridge part. And that's why I was asking, like, if we might know who all is up there. Sorry, Barton, I know you're raising your
hand. First of all, my focus has always been on the Texas School Book Depository and Prayer Man. I don't worry about what's happening on the knoll or on top of the viaduct and so forth, because I can't get a real answer from that. I always stay with Oswald and his last 48 hours and what happened and what his movements were and so forth and what people in the Texas School Book Depository did, the FBI, the Secret Service, the DPD, and so forth. But I'm going to paste in a link, which is important, and I want you all to look at. This comes from John Kellen. And this is on Ray Marcus. And Ray Marcus studied the Mormon Polaroid. And he basically looked at the pictures inside that folder. Now, for me, if anything or anyone pointed the shooters behind the picket fence, I think Ray Marcus is pretty close. Because there are elements in these photos that aren't natural, that aren't bushes. They are people. I don't believe in badge man at all. Because I'll tell you one thing. I've been looking at that picture, that Polaroid, on that side for God knows how many times. And I cannot find what Jack White and Gary Mack found. I can't find it. I can't see it. Maybe that's my shortcoming, but I just don't see it. But I look at Ray Marcus's pictures, and I go, now that looks like something. Not much, but something. Without drawing and coloring and so forth. He just basically separates the bits and looks at it and goes, hold on a minute, there's something there. Ray Marcus did that, what, 55, 58 years ago already. I think it's really good, and that I find really interesting. But sorry, I'm deflecting a little bit. But yeah, over to you, Dave.
All right, Bart. Erica, thank you. I want to thank you for joining us. I had never seen you in our meetings before, but everybody's welcome, and I'm glad that we're reaching new people. And you've got some great questions. One thing I want to throw out here is when I went to David Denton's conference in Olney, Illinois at the campus, Larry Rivera was in attendance. And this is where I was first bringing this, you know, presentation out of the AR-5, AR-7 shooter on the bridge. Now I talked to him because in his book, which I will throw again because, you know, it's the Project JFK Bible, so to speak, the JFK Horseman that Larry Rivera wrote. I think there's great information there, and there was a section about whether there was a shooter down underneath, hidden below the overpass. and possibly like a radio man up on top of the bridge. When I showed Larry my Tom Dillard photo and all my information that I'd done on research, and I spent 5 years on this, bringing it out, going and doing, you know, the legwork, going to all the different manufacturers, warehouses, ballistic experts, going and talking to police departments, and interviewing snipers. One of the main questions that came up was, you know, how could somebody get this rifle into Dealey Plaza? Well, hell, getting rifles in and out of Dealey Plaza didn't seem to be a problem. But just to throw this out, the AR-5, this is a picture of the AR-7. The AR-5 is the exact same rifle. The difference is one is semi-automatic and one is bolt action. They both break down and fit inside the butt of the gun. Well, it had been raining that morning. Some people still had raincoats on, or long jackets. When I was at Olney Central College, I did my entire presentation, and I walked on stage with my AR-7, which is the one you see pictured here. I walked on stage. I had it underneath my suit coat. I wasn't wearing a long coat. I was just wearing a suit coat. And men back in the day, what was the number one, you know, idea of how they dressed? They dressed in suits and hats. That's what they dressed in. This gun is, you know, this weapon is easily concealable. For a long gun especially. I mean, you can conceal a pistol or a handgun, but a rifle? Rifles are hard to conceal. This one's not. The barrel, the action, the two clips, everything fits in the stock of the gun. So when I pulled it out on stage and I assembled it, and I'm just holding it up with, you know, just my thumb and two fingers, Larry wrote a great blog on his website. And if you guys have not visited...
I just posted it up there on the chat.
Okay. If you guys have not visited Larry's blog and his website, I beg of you to go and look at the information this man puts out. I was really happy that he, you know, took and put this out on his website. And I'd done this presentation here in Kansas where I'm located at. It went to Washington. It went to Dallas. It went to Illinois. And it's been online globally. It's one of those things that once you see it, you can't unsee it and go, it makes perfect sense. Everything ties back to this particular weapon that could have caused a throat shot.
Hey, David, even 007 used a version of it.
Yeah, the movie From Russia with Love with Sean Connery, 007. And in my presentation, I put in there, was art imitating life? The funny thing about it was that I've got it here on a slide. Just a second. Let me do a quick screen share. Yeah, this is in my presentation. But if you go back and look at the movie From Russia with Love, it was released October 10th and 11th, 1963, in London and the United Kingdom. The film was released in the United States April 8th, 1964. Well, what happened between the UK and London release and the US release? The JFK assassination. And what was used for in the movie was, it was used for an assassination. The rifle only weighs 2.5 pounds. The barrel length is 14 inches. The length of the butt of the gun is 28. And the total length is 42 inches. And it was produced in 1956 it was put into the United States Air Force in 1956. It was released for civilian use in 1959. And again, General Curtis LeMay is the general that got this for the Air Force. This was a survival rifle that was put under the ejector seats, or to the side of the ejector seats if a pilot had to punch out and try to survive for, you know, taking down small game or something until help could arrive. when I remember back when Larry saw it, and as a matter of fact, I even had people like Bill Kelly and Dr. David Mantic, when he looked at it and saw the ballistics and how it matches the throat wound in size, he was blown away by it. It's just, like I say, it's food for thought out there of, you know, everything seems to have started with the throat shot. You know, everybody talks about the head shot. And I decided, you know, I was going to do something, of, you know, can I come up with something else that leans to a front shooter so I could disprove the low nut assassin? And could I figure out how the hell that hole in the windshield got caused? And could I find something that did not come from the grassy knoll? Well, the hole in the windshield doesn't line up with the grassy knoll. It lines up from, well, Sherry Feaster put it in as the headshot coming from the south knoll. In her cone of trajectory, I'm not going to discredit it. I think in her book, Enemy of the Truth, she was great with her research. But as far as a throat shot goes, that's not what she was looking at. She was looking at a headshot. A lot of people look at going, okay, when they hear my presentation, they say, oh, you're talking about the headshot. No, I'm talking about the throat shot. The throat shot is what got the other teams. One, I feel that immobilized Kennedy, if he would have survived, they just shot out his damn throat box, his larynx box. He wasn't going to tell shit no more. He could have wrote things down, but he wouldn't have been the public speaker. How was he going to be a president after that if he couldn't talk? So I think the throat shot was very important to go through and do the research. But in the research, I'm trying to figure out, okay, in the research, how does this fit into our case? Bob, I see your question was, AR-5 available commercially at the time? Yes. The AR-5 was available commercially in 1963. The AR-7 was available for commercial use in 1963. The difference between the AR-5 and the AR-7, when I go back to, I'm just going to show you the bullet real quick. Give me just a sec. When I talk about the AR-5 being the rifle that I choose, bolt action doesn't stick. Semi-automatic will, but when we look at the 22 Hornet round, this is the shell that came out of that gun. It's 2.3 times the muzzle velocity and 7 times the energy of the common 22 long rifle. It's got a ballistic tip. It's like a perfect missile. This will penetrate a windshield. Hell, a 22 long rifle will penetrate a windshield. But when you look at it in comparison, a 22 and a 22 long rifle, they're the ones here on the left and the right. This 22 that's next to the 22 Hornet, this is called a 22 Magnum. But the 22 Hornet, yeah, ballistic tip. It's going to pierce through a windshield. It's going to cause a perfect hole. It's going to cause a perfect round hole in the throat. When you look at the specifications, it's 5.7 millimeters in the diameter. Velocity, let's see here, velocity 3,060 feet per second. Energy, that's 35 grain Vmax. The 55 grain comes at 2,652 feet per second, 859 foot-pounds. That's
Hey, David?
Yeah.
I just emailed something to you at Project JFK, and I also sent it to Larry Rivera. If one of you could pull it up on your screen share.
Okay.
It relates to this subject.
All right, let me go into my email here real quick. You said you sent that to Project JFK?
Yeah.
Okay. And for those of you that have not emailed me before, my email address is projectjfk@yahoo.com. The one says Lambert thesis?
Yeah. If you could open it up on a screen share and we'll just kind of look at it real quick.
Yeah, let me download it here real fast. All right, give me just a quick sec. Let me do a screen share. Okay, here we go.
Yeah, I've referenced this, I think, in some prior meetings and whatnot, but this guy was a master sergeant in the Air Force, and this is his master's thesis. And he's looking at what happens to a bullet fired through commercial glass, plate glass, say in a hostage situation for the benefit of police. So, it's fascinating as you work. This is the whole document, and feel free to share it with everybody. But, I stumbled across this, and it came to me by way of some public access to the Air Force. I didn't find it on the UCLA site, but anyway, long story short, he tests jacketed, unjacketed bullet. I think it's a 308. Different angles of incidence, some straight perpendicular to the glass, some at an angle. And he goes into a great amount of detail of what happens to the bullet as it goes through the glass. But basically, the bullet will typically mushroom. A lot of cases, the jacket gets stripped away, and it becomes a flying piece of shrapnel along with the bullet. But the bullet gets deformed, and also it tumbles. In every case, the bullet tumbles, regardless of the angle that it's shot at.
Yeah, it goes into a yaw.
Yeah, so you have this issue. This is a thing that concerned me with a shot through the windshield, because that windshield is laminated. It wasn't bulletproof, but it was pretty stout. So and the angle that it would have hit, of course, it's nowhere near perpendicular, right? So you've got in terms of your aim, and then if you're aiming at JFK, where would you aim on the windshield, knowing that the bullet's going to deflect and not go through in the straight path at which you were aiming? But feel free to share this with the community and look through it and everything. But I think it's pretty convincing that the possibility of a shot that went through the windshield, if some way it did hit JFK, to leave a round, pristine hole like that is extremely remote, because the bullet would have deformed, and it also would have been not at its original axis as it was shot towards the windshield, pitch yaw, flipping, whatever you want to call it. So you definitely would have. And actually, this is what happened with the shot that hit Martin Luther King, right? Very similar shot. In fact, I, in the back recesses of my mind in the wee hours of the morning, often wondered if the guy that killed King wasn't the same guy that shot Kennedy in the throat. And I'll say that here for the record. Very, very similar shots. The only thing, I don't know if King moved slightly or if the shot was slightly higher, but instead of hitting King exactly in the throat where the shot hit Kennedy, it clipped his jawbone, his mandible. And then after that impact, that bullet started to pitch and yaw, and it worked its way whirly-birding through, severed the carotid, a bunch of vessels, the spinal cord. It just wiped him out. And if you read a book, I think, written by Craig Roberts, where he talks, I think it's Killzone, where he talks about that triangle of the throat area, that any sniper, if you want to kill somebody, this is where you aim. You aim for the throat, because there's so much stuff you can do damage with there. So anyway, just thought I would share that, because I think it's worth the read if we're going to continue this discussion. I just think there's a lot of risk. And the other thing is, I think something I said in previous presentations, I think no matter who was shooting, was they were very good, competent riflemen. And I'm just trying to wrap my head around the idea that somebody who's really a good shooter and a shooting to kill would take a purposeful shot through the windshield. I just can't wrap my head around that.
Yeah, I don't think he was trying to shoot through the windshield. I think he was trying to shoot over the windshield. I mean, hell, he could have been shooting Kennedy right in the face.
Yeah, I've done that math, and this is something I actually argued with Sherry Feaster. There were a couple of us that interrupted her presentation at Lancer on this, because in her book, at one point she makes the comment, I think she actually did it during a presentation, that the shot could have gone over the windshield, in which case I almost stood up and did backflips, because I've done that math based on the elevations in Dealey Plaza and looking at the topo map. you have to be 16 feet above grade on the overpass to clear the windshield. So it did, there's no, in fact, one of my earlier presentations, the angle of obstruction that that windshield creates is very wide. You have to be way over to the left on the north, on the south knoll, but in the Cancellari photo, way away from the underpass, coming in from the side of the limousine, or you have to be over in the right front, along the north knoll, well, the one we always talk about. So you've got to be wide, either way left or way right, otherwise you're dealing with the windshield.
Yeah, one quick thing I want to throw in here is I'm going to show this video. It's on YouTube. It's not my video, but I had some people that asked, okay, a 22 is not going to go through a windshield. Now, this is not a bulletproof windshield. This is, you know, in a late model vehicle. This is video was taken about 8 years ago. I want to give full credit to Full Mag's channel. But I'm just gonna do a quick show here real fast of it. It's only a minute long. The guy's shooting into a windshield of a pickup truck. He's firing a 22 long rifle. This isn't the 22 Hornet. This is actually the smaller of the two. And he'll put a hole right through the windshield. And a lot of people say, oh no, the 22 will just bounce right off the windshield. There's no way it's gonna, you know, go through. The bullet goes right through the windshield, goes right through the headrest, and right out the back. And he's going to shoot it again so you can see it.
So you got enough kinetic energy to go right through.
Yeah. And you're and like I say, you're not talking about the 22 long rifle. You're talking about just the bullet of a 22. Now the first shot was down low. It hits the bottom of the headrest. The second shot is up a little bit higher. And look what comes through. And that's not actually pierced through the back windshield. All that is just part of the fiber from the windshield. Or part, that's the fiber from the headrest that stuck to the back windshield. So it's not like it went through the windshield and then went right back out, you know, through the back of the windshield. And we're talking about that's a 22, which is that's a lead tip bullet. There's no jacketing whatsoever. The 22 Hornet is a jacketed bullet. Now, they say that some bullet fragments look like they were removed from the windshield. That's what was stated in the eyewitness reports. The 22 Hornet is a jacketed bullet. The jacket, it could have been stripped off, you know, mushroomed off the bullet, and the lead core is what hit Kennedy in the throat. I'm not disagreeing with the trajectory of how the bullet can tumble or how it can yaw. That's the terminology, yaw. You know, sometimes the bullet will come straight out, and then when it hits, I've seen it and I've done it where I've hit sheetrock or phone books and the bullet comes straight out like this, but when it hits its target and it starts to tumble, it'll actually go through the air, you know, straight up. So instead of making a perfect hole, it'll make an oval or, you know, something other than a hole. When I talk to snipers, that I've interviewed, when I've talked to manufacturers, I said, okay, difference between, I showed them what my research was. I said, between the 22 Hornet, which is the AR-7, I'm sorry, the 22 Hornet, which is the AR-5, and the 22 Long Rifle, which is the 22 Long Rifle, which is the AR-7, I said, one's a jacketed bullet, one's unjacketed, one's a ballistic tip, and one is a hollow point, or a solid point, you know, which means it would be just a full piece of lead with no hole in the tip. I said, which one is going to cause my perfect hole? Which one is going to cause the hole of a, you know, number two pencil? Which one could cause the hole in the throat, being what the Parkland doctors described as a perfect round entrance hole? And they said it would not be the 22 long rifle round. It would be the 22 Hornet rifle round that comes out of AR-5. So when I put my presentation together and I put this out there, I said both weapons were Both weapons were available at the time. Both shots sounds like a firecracker. The difference is, the reason why I lean towards AR-5, the velocity of the bullet, the ballistic tip of the bullet, and the guy is shooting through the windshield. We don't know. We don't know if it was a shooter on the bridge. Number two, we don't know if the shooter was shooting at the throat, if he was shooting at Kennedy in the face or in the head. We just know that we have photographic evidence. We have, you know, an idea that the shot came from the front. Even Dr. Perry said that it looked like a, you know, front wound. Go ahead, Larry. You got your hand up. You're on mute.
Yeah, I just want to play a couple of the slides that I have lined up for November.
Okay.
Maybe, I don't know if this is going to, I don't know if you'll be able to hear this.
I can't hear anything. I can see the photographs.
Well, that's the thing. I think I need to enable the sound here some way.
Make sure that you're
right.
Make sure that your sound is sound same as system. It should be already, but make sure when you click on the little microphone on the bottom, it says sound same as system.
Same as system, yeah. It says.
All right, try that.
Well, it's same as system right now. How about?
I know Zoom sometimes picks up the sound through your micro or through your speakers on your computer. You have speakers.
Yeah, let's try that.
Okay.
Hold on, let me go in here. I just switched to that.
Yeah. All right, go ahead and do your share screen again.
And let's do this. No? Yes or no?
Nope, I can't hear it.
All right.
Well, even though we can't hear it, Larry, tell us what it is that you're showing us.
Well, you know, it's important to listen to what they're saying, so we'll just have to...
Okay, we'll do it in Dallas then.
Yep. All right.
Well, I will climb off my soapbox. Sorry, sometimes you get on something and you don't know how to let go of the goddamn thing. You just keep tearing at it. Would anybody else like to talk about something else? Or would you like to ask some questions of our fellow researchers? I see Bob's got a question in here that says, can't recall, did James Tague say anything about the sound from his above the left? I don't know if I don't remember Tague saying anything. Of course, I mean, hell, he shot, you know, he's ricocheted shot off the curb onto his cheek. That would basically throw me off on, you know, just taking cover. I don't know if, I can't recall that he said anything about hearing, you know, shots above him or, around him. Feaster's calculation suggests a throat shot from the mid parting lot, but the level is further up the hill. I have to get a new mouse.
By the way, we have Mike Machanska here today, and I know I've noticed he's been at other meetings, and Mike is a photographic expert who works in California within the Hollywood environment, and he knows he's pointed a lot of discrepancies on photos and images that we know have been altered in the JFK record there. And just about everything that survived has been tampered with in one way or another. And actually, Beverly Brunson was also very, very much convinced of that back in the 60s. And people like Mike notice stuff like that, and we go and check it out, and he's always right. So, welcome, Mike.
One thing I'm looking here in the comments, Peter, PM here, he was talking about Sherry Feaster, and I've got a couple of her, slides in my presentation. Let me increase this. Yeah, her throat shot trajectory, comes in at 15 degrees. If we zoom in, she puts the cone. Now, this is where I have my shooter on the bridge, and she's got the cone over in this area. I personally think her cone is a few degrees off.
But she's through the windshield there, too.
Yeah. Let's see here. Let me go back. What other slides do I have of hers that I've got in here? Let's see. If the shot came from the south, grassy knoll, this will explain the hole in the windshield and the shot to JFK's throat. She's got the, see, and the thing is I worked on this and came out with my presentation. This was right after Sherry passed away, so I'd never got a chance to sit down, and I love Sherry to death. I mean, we spent a lot of time when I was working with Lancer. I trust Sherry's, research, but she's got, the hole coming through the windshield, hitting JFK in the throat. I just personally disagree with it being, 15 degrees. I have a thing with it being 15 degrees. This is the viewpoint if you were on the, south knoll compared to, and this is ground level. This is midway up the hill, and this would be at the top of the hill compared to where I put mine. Directly, and if we look, I mean, the car couldn't have been any better that day. The car is right in the center, basically almost where the throat shot happened. The car's coming right at you. It's not a sideways shot. I think her 15-degree cone was a few degrees off.
But given that distance, David, why would you take a shot from there when you could take it right behind the fence over on the north knoll and have an unobstructed clear path to the throat from over there?
I think it lines up the triangular crossfire. I think there had to be a shooter directly in front of the limo at the – there had to be a shooter in front – my personal belief, I think in order to have a trajectory crossfire, you're going to have one down text building. You're going to have a shooter on one of the two knolls, whether you believe north knoll or south knoll, and you're going to have one directly in front. You're going to have your Patsy shot coming from the TSBD. It sets Oswald up. But in order to get a triangular crossfire, you're going to have one here, one over here, and one on the bridge. I mean, if you wanted to take Kennedy out, why the hell didn't – if Oswald was supposedly the shooter – why the hell didn't he take the shot when Kennedy's coming right at him up Houston?
Very good question.
The shot had to happen on Elm Street because that's where the teams were at, and the teams were spaced in a triangular crossfire.
What's interesting is we can debate this for another 20 years. The
other thing
is, based on what Larry just said, with all the alterations to the films and the video and the pictures and everything, It's hard to even know at the end of the day, what are we actually looking at and basing our judgment and our measurements and all of that, because things have been altered,
Right.
So it's almost like you have to sometimes say, what are we trying to do this for? Because a lot of it's going to involve some degree of conjecture, because you just don't know.
Well, the one thing that I throw out there is when I went back to find the Tom Dillard photo, I mean, it's kind of weird. I mean, I kind of pulled, and I've said this before, I kind of pulled a Kevin Costner, Sissy Spacek, JFK moment. When he wakes up in the middle of the night and he thinks, about Oswald, and he talks about his dog, playing chess. I went to sleep. Obviously, I had book. I mean, I passed the hell out. I had books on me and stuff, and I had dreamed about, because I was working on it, I dreamed about, you know, the front shooter, where the hell could it be? And in the dream, I had saw the uncropped version of the Tom Dillard photo. When you go back and look at the Tom Dillard photo, almost every publication that put that photograph out, it stops right at the taillight on the passenger side where you don't see the top of the bridge. Now, that photograph's been out there, and, you know, this was done in 2016, so we're talking from 63 to 2016. That photograph's been out there in the public domain for people to see for decades, decades. And when I'm looking at that photograph in the uncropped version, which I was kind of wondering why it wasn't shown, I mean, whenever you'd see the photograph in publication, that photograph was always cropped. Why? They're not cropping out but about this much of the photograph. What was so important it needed to be cropped out? Was it space in the publication they were putting it in? No. Hell no. I think they cropped out that photograph because that was one thing they didn't go in and erase out. Like we see in some of the films where we have blackouts, where we have, you know, cameras missing in the Knicks film or in the Zapruder film. So when I go back and look at that photograph, it's not like I made the damn thing. It's in the negative. It's in the print photograph. Why did we not look at this before? It's just a question. Go ahead, Patrick.
On the issue of why we look at the evidence and what we can actually discern from it, as opposed to speculation and so forth. It's interesting with regard to the frontal wound that the doctors at Parkland were very experienced at seeing gunshot wounds, and they described it as having a uniform nature, such as an entrance wound would have, number one. Number two, it's humorous almost that the next day when J. Edgar Hoover, who should be a reliable source, in the sense of his sources, is speaking with LBJ on the phone, and LBJ is asking what happened. Hoover says in a recorded phone call, well, when the limo was approaching the TSPD on Houston, a shot was fired into Kennedy's throat from the front, and that subsequently the car turned around the corner, and then later another shot was scene. So that speaks to the uniformity of the what appeared to be more so of an entrance wound in the front also being incorrect. But Hoover didn't know what he was saying at that time. And tangentially, if not tangential, the idea of the Zapruder film's importance cannot be overstated. That's a perfect example of that.
Yeah, one thing is I go back to the, you know, to the testimony of why the brake lights were, you know, showing up on the car, and we see them in the film, in the Knicks film. I'm sure that's not the only film. But we see the brake lights come on, and they ask the driver, "Why'd you hit the brakes?" "I was driving into the gunfire." Into, which tells me that means there's a shot coming from the front. If he was driving away from the gunfire and Oswald's in the sixth floor, or some shooter's in the sixth floor, they pin it on, you know, the Patsy Oswald, he would have been driving away from the shots, not
into. I agree
with
you.
So,
hey, guys, I got something to add to that.
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I was just listening to other witness testimony earlier today, and so many people have said right when the limo turned onto Elm from Houston, they heard shots that early. Just go back and look at it. And so that was always the first question. Why didn't the Patsy? They set up the Patsy to shoot at the most obvious area. And I think they did. And Larry could speak to this better than me. We both found elements of the Towner film that were obviously altered. Yeah, Larry Sound's the guy.
I did point this out when I was in Facebook at the time to Tom, Tina Towner, and she said, "Oh, I didn't notice that exactly." I'll post the article that on the blog that we did together, Mike, in the chat right now. Okay.
Yeah, thing, Larry Sound, and Mike Brownlow, when I was in Dallas, he pointed this out to me. He knew all those people. He knew the guy who Larry Sound that they all altered out right below the Deltex window on fire escape there, and that's why a lot of these, all these other photos have been altered. And I was the one who found that that one photo on the Towner film on the turn, Jackie Kennedy and JFK have been heavily altered and basically just copied one photo, and it's the same expression on that turn until they cut away. So anyway,
it's up on the chat for whoever wants the entire analysis, Mike.
Right. Well, one thing I just want to point out is that Mike Brown knew that guy who was on that fire escape, and he talked to him, and he said, "Where did the shot come?" He said, "Right under my ass, right above my ass." I can't remember exactly, but so there's a lot to be said that these shots were much earlier than we see on the altered Zapruder film. And I last thing, I think what we see in the Zapruder film, him, Kennedy covering his throat with his hands, that's heavily altered. I think the throat shot came earlier, and they couldn't show multiple shots, and everyone knew there was a throat shot, so they had to show that at some point. So I think the throat shot came much earlier than was shown in the Zapruder. So thanks, Larry.
The photograph, Mike, you're talking about, the Alkin 6. That's where he's got his hands up near his throat. And Alkins is standing, well, depending on where you want to place him at, either on the curb or in the street. I think he was in the damn street when he took the photograph. In Alkin 6, it shows JFK, grabbing his throat. I know I talked to Dr. Tony Glover when I did an interview with her in Dealey Plaza, and she was an eyewitness, a little kid that was out there. But she knew what the hell was going on. She was sitting there watching the car. It went right past her on Houston and made the left on Elm, and she's watching the car. And I asked her, I said, "When did you first hear the shot? When did you first hear the first shot?" And she goes, the first time she heard a shot was when it lined up with the throat shot, which would have been the throat shot. And I said, "So did you hear any shots while the car was on Houston or the moment it turned onto Elm?" And she said, "Not until the car was in front of the building and JFK was reacting to the throat shot." Now, where was Tony Glover at? She was standing on top of one of the pergolas right there on the corner of Houston and Elm. So she was able to see the car come up Houston, make the turn, and the car's going away from her, but she can see JFK reacting to the throat shot. Now, what she tells me, or what she told me, was the first shot she heard was when JFK was grabbing towards his throat. Other eyewitnesses are in different locations. But where was the car at? We already know the Alkin 6 photograph was altered. We did a scan last year. Gary Fannin had gotten the slide, negative. And me and Brian and Larry Rivera sat there and did a scan. We're going to rescan it again this year. And I've got another fellow researcher, Craig Bozarth, who's going to be bringing his digital microscope with him. And we're going to go in and look at the negative, even more in depth than what I did on my scans. I really want to start picking the shit out. I want to pick the gnat shit out of Pepper, out of that negative, and see what we thought we saw, or what we think is there, to what truly is in that photograph and what has been altered. We know alterations have been done to that negative from the original. I want to kind of start a tally, every little spot I want to pick out in that negative to find out what's been altered, what looks like it's been altered. It was the car where it was, actually at, from where Alkins himself didn't position the car someplace else. But if alterations are done on the photographs, alterations are done on the films, and adulteration, there's a difference between alteration and adulteration when it comes to photographs and videos. which one is it? You know, which, where's the car at? When you look at the photographs and the videos, you see lines of people up and down Elm Street. And then when you look at other videos, it looks like there's huge ass spaces in between. Was it perspective, or was it alteration or adulteration? These are things we have to look at. We take the technology we have now that we didn't have in the 1960s, 70s, or 80s, or 90s. But with what we've got now at our fingertips and what we can look at, that's why it's so damn important to keep doing the research we're doing and to get new generations of researchers involved, because the younger generation, I mean, I'm going to be 49 in a couple weeks. Somehow I always seem to celebrate my birthday in Dallas. But the younger generation that has the, I mean, technology to them is like second nature. Those are the ones that got to take a look at this and figure out where can we go next and what the hell can we use to go back and look at the photographic and the video evidence that we have and make heads or tails out of this. We're doing a great job so far, but I want new eyes on this. I want new people coming to our meetings and coming to the conferences and asking questions like Erica did today. That's why we do this. Eventually, you know, hell, 5, 10, 20 years down the road, some of us are going to be gone. Eyewitnesses are going to be gone. We've already lost a lot of people in the last decade that we can't go back and ask. That's one of the reasons why the footage that I'm releasing on the website and on the YouTube channel, I feel is so important, because a lot of the people that's interviewed in that, they're not here anymore. But the moment they give an interview, even to a novice researcher, or an author writing a book, their testimony that they give to that person becomes the historical record. And we have to rely on that to be able to piece this shit together. So, any more questions? Oh, there was a question from Bob. On the Diller photo, I do believe that is James Tague to the front of that follow-up car. Yeah, I think that's James Tague standing there right below the bridge where he got where he was standing where he got struck at.
I got a quick question.
Go ahead, Brooks.
Yeah, has everybody seen the Max Good documentary that he did on Ruth Payne? Came out a few months ago. I just happened to see it the other night. It's called Ruth Payne and the Assassination, I think, or something like that. It's almost 2 hours long.
I have not seen that yet.
Okay. It's worth a watch. It's really, it's definitely worth a watch. I'll just leave it at that.
I got it off
of Amazon.
Oh, okay. Okay. I saw that in my search. I'm not going to just throw this off of what I know, but let me zoom in here and back me up on this. Is this James Tague in the Diller photo? Right here.
Yes.
That's James Tague.
Yeah.
So, yeah, when I talked about earlier how they showed the crop version in publications, where they crop it at, if you look at this middle taillight and you cut that sumbitch directly in half, this right here up to his ear is what they show in the crop version. So this is what bothered me of why, I mean, it took searching to find this damn thing. I looked through photographs in books, and I have a lot of books on my shelf. But why would you crop out this one? What are you talking? Maybe, hell, if you're looking at it 100%, you're looking maybe what, an inch and a quarter of a photograph? Why would you crop that section out of the photograph and print that, but not show this? Are you cropping it out and not showing it because of this? Is it because of Tague? Because when you look at the crop photograph, you don't see Tague in it. It crops right here at the back of that taillight in the center. To the left. Gone. The uncropped, you see Tague, and you see what's on the bridge. It's a question that has to be asked.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the whole Tague thing didn't come forward, I think, until June of 64.
Yeah.
They were way down the road with their narrative. And that thing bubbled up out of nowhere and totally upset where they were going, because they didn't have to deal with Tague. So, yeah, I think maybe hiding both, but I would put my chips to say definitely hiding hay. Hay.
Yeah. Well, here's the question. The piece of concrete they cut out on the curb where the bullet struck and then bounced up and hit hay. I have those photographs. When was that piece of concrete taken out? Do you know, Brooks? Was it 63 or was it 64?
I think it was, gosh, I'm trying to remember now.
I can't recall off the top of my head. I know I've got it in my notes, but I'm already.
I do remember it was there. People had seen it, and I'm trying to remember that story. And then they went back like a day or two later, and it was cut out and gone. But I can't remember the timeline.
They knew about TAG. They knew about the ricocheted bullet and the bullet hitting the concrete in November 63.
They sure did. But they buried it. They got away with it. I think it was somebody ran the story in the paper. It was a newspaper story that ran in June. And all of a sudden it bubbled up and they had to deal with it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we asked, as researchers, we asked the questions that the government and the people that did the cover up don't want us to ask. But like I just said this in a public speaking class at college the other day, I said, and I was talking to a group of students, hell, even I'm older than a teacher by about 8 years, 9 years. And I told the kids, I told the students probably 19 to 22 in that class, I told him, I said, I said, the relevance of what this speech is, and it was only, I had to give the JFK assassination speech as a persuasive speech in 5 minutes. Now, I had to have 3 points, 6 subpoints. You know how goddamn hard it is to talk about this and try to give somebody an answer in 5 minutes? I mean, it was probably one of the hardest speeches I've had to write so far for this semester. I'm used to talking for an hour presentation, and I had 5 minutes to do this. But I told the kids the students as a memorable close, I said, it is up to you to pick up this mantle and to go with it, because you're the next generation that has to inherit this. We don't have the case solved. We don't have all the answers. Hell, we don't even have all the documents released yet. And it's up to you to take what we're doing, add to it, and get us to the finish line. Erica, you got your hand up. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. So I'm just broader question, I guess. So there's so many interesting things to me that are happening in that neutral ground of Dealey Plaza in terms of just like the civil infrastructure. Like we're talking about the James Tigg curb, piece, right, that gets replaced, like you said, Brooks, I guess, days, weeks later or whatever. Remember the video of the crew doing it? Like it was a newsreel thing, but I don't remember exactly when it was, but it was very soon thereafter. We obviously have the, I can't remember the woman's name, but she notes that there's, some bullet holes in the grass, she's like, oh, there's some, looks like a mole went through here, but went the other way kind of thing. And then obviously you've got the 2 days beforehand, the day beforehand, they painted some yellow marks right where the kill zone ends up being. And then like 2 days later after that, they end up like changing those two yellow lines right next to where the limousine is, right? Kind of where Mary and Jean are. I'm just wondering if, broadly speaking, if somebody who's, I'm not that much younger than you are, David, but a little bit younger, so I guess I'm technically different generation, as much as I'm a millennial and you're a Gen Xer, has there been research done on just, I know that obviously there was the survey team that came out from Life magazine and stuff like that. I just feel like what's happening there from just a city of Dallas civil infrastructure perspective, somebody has to make the decision of, I'm going to randomly paint two yellow lines on the side of the street where nobody would ever park anyway, because we're not in Britain. We don't drive on that side of the road. So why would you paint two yellow lines there? And then has to make the decision somewhere in city management. Somebody has to make that decision. Likewise, somebody has to say, hey, crew of five guys, go out and move this one little piece of curb infrastructure. I'm guessing, unlike police records, you probably don't have archival documentation of that, probably got destroyed 3 or 4 years later or whatever, if it was even kept. But there's just so much interesting stuff happened there. Is anyone familiar with anybody who's done a lot of research in this or any books maybe I should read or something like that, or if this is maybe just an area that would be possibly interesting, because to me it's like there are angles there of things that don't hit people, that obviously something happened, bullets went flying, and that somebody is scouting what would be a good spot from a grassy knoll perspective and from the the opposite side perspective that you can see, and from Deltex, you can actually see those yellow lines very clearly from all those vantage points there. So I'm just curious if there are some names I should maybe look into.
Yeah, a couple quick comments on that. That always intrigued me too, because those markings are spaced out about every 50 feet, and that you can see them in a whole bunch of images. They're all up
and there's more than just two, Brooks.
Yeah, there's like five or six of them. And, but what was interesting is Casey found a period photo well before November 63. And according to what he's seen, those markings were there. Maybe it's just for new divers because the road curves, but Gene Hill said that she stepped off the curb that day and there was yellow paint on the bottom of her foot, which means at least a couple of those were probably freshly painted over, which is always, until Casey found the period photo well before November 63, I was always of the suspicion those were done in the wee hours the night before, because that is a convenient way to mark the kill zone, if you will, or who, you know, the sequence of the different shooting teams, who's the fire when, that type of a thing. So just, that's just all I know about that. But
when me and Brian went to the Dallas Public Library, we found photographs that were, you know, donated to the library. And one of the photographs that we popped in and looked at, this was, you know, in 63, and people were out there putting flowers and stuff right after the assassination. You can see plainly right here one of those yellow lines. And yeah, Casey found that, you know, I back this up what Brooke said. Casey found that the yellow lines were put there prior to 63, but they were freshly painted the day before the parade. Now, I know sometimes when you have something going on, hell, just look at what they did on the 50th. You know, they always want to go in and try to, you know, beautify the area. If they're, I mean, they have a parade here every year, you know, they have several in the area and parades I've been in. They seem to always want to go in and try to do the best they can to make the grounds or the roads look the best for the event. Could that be the explanation of why those yellow lines were repainted, freshly painted? Obviously, if Jean stepped off the curb, had yellow paint on her shoes, the point has to state, I mean, you have to understand, okay, that shit just got painted recently. Like, it hasn't had time to even dry. Were they out there painting it the morning before the car came down the road? Did they paint it the night before? And because of, you know, the moisture and the rain that was coming down, the paint didn't have time to set and dry. Now, the paint we use today in roadway markings, the moment they spray the lines down on the ground, it dries damn near instantly. But if you're out there with a paint bucket and a brush or a roller, that's not typical paint that you would use in, you know, road work paint. That is, you know, paint that you're just, you know, painting with. So I like to believe Gene Hill's story that, you know, she stepped off the curb, she stepped into yellow paint. I think the fact that they were already there probably helped the teams to figure out where the kill zone was going to be. I mean, when you're a sniper, and Brian's gone, but Brian will back this up because I took it right from him. When you're a sniper, you have this area. This is from point A to point B. This is where you take your shot. If you're another sniper, another team, you get point A to point B. And if the car or the target is outside that zone, you don't fire. So I think the yellow lines on the curb you could have seen those yellow, they, as we saw in the photograph, they were not only on the face of the curb, which means facing the road itself, but they were on the top of the curb. So if we have a shooter on the bridge, if we have a shooter in a Dowtex building, or the TSBD or wherever the hell the shooters are at, if you're aerial, you can see those lines. If you were a shooter in the drain and you were popped up and looking, you were at ground level. You would have seen those lines on the face. I think those lines played into the fact of where those shots were supposed to be taken. And I think those lines were used by the shooting team, depending on which sniper it was, this is your area. So, I like going back and looking at the photographs, like what we found in, at the library. I know most generation of kids today, you know, the younger generation, my kids go to the library. Most kids, they're like, nope, I'm going to go online. I'm going to find what I need because I'm not going to the library. When I was a kid, I was at the library all the time. I still go to the library. But I think that's a key thing. You got to go back and look at the original evidence and find out what's still available. What we found is a treasure trove of information down at Dallas Public Library, and what we were able to scan or take photographs of. It's important. It's going back looking at the evidence with fresh eyes and maybe things that people haven't seen in decades.
And one of the positions that when I was working, I still do on the blender model, and nobody ever mentions, everybody says the top of the roof of the records building, but the roof of the Dow Tech building offers an even better angle into the shot in the back, you know, or, you know, whatever, and nobody's ever talked about the roof. They talk about the second floor and the roof of the records building, but never the roof of the Dow Techs.
We lost some of your microphone right there at the end, Larry.
That's a very interesting position to consider.
Yeah, I definitely think the roof is definitely would be a great shot. Because one of the, you had a couple problems from behind, particularly the Dow Techs, Larry, is you got the agents on both sides of the running board. So if you're low in the Dow Techs, you've got a narrow, because they're standing up, they're going to be in the way, right? So that comes into play depending upon your position. But if you go high in the Dow Techs and even up on the roof, they're particularly for a shot fairly early, that angle down, that's the optimum place to be, would be on the Dow Techs.
Well, I mean, when
the limb was going, the limb was going directly away from you. So the left to right motion is, I mean, that's shooting fish in a barrel.
The thing that people, you know, so many different theories, you know, of who shot from where, the way that I have worked it has been, you know, reverse engineering, you know, from the evidence going back. And that helps a lot also.
I was going to say, another thing that Brian and Casey exposed me to years ago was the possible shooting location of the parked truck, the laundry truck, on
the Towner vans.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good, perfect shooting location there as well. And the nice thing of it is, I mean, you're blocked by laundry bags. Now, I know that's going to absorb some of the sound, but will it make the sound absorb so much as being, would depend on what the hell rifle they use.
If
there's silence, I mean, you're not going to hear a firecracker sound anyway.
Has anybody ever identified what laundry truck that was? What company? That would be really important to know based on some research I've done. But
as far as I know, nobody, I don't personally know of anybody that's actually gotten a company name off of the, you know, a company name off the side of the vehicle. It's just like the guy that's walking across Elm Street with the hammer in his hand. Brian brought this up. I mean, we get kind of a name off of him, but we don't really have a company to go back for. And then again, even if we did have a name, was it a stolen uniform? Did somebody, you know, I mean, how many times we've seen a video where, you know, they take and put a name on a vehicle, but it's not really their vehicle.
Right.
I just saw this. What the hell was it? It was, I forgot what show I was watching, but, they're looking for a guy with a truck bomb, and he paints it to look like one of the police vehicles. The only way they caught him was the fact that they see the paint starting to streak on the side of the vehicle. So even if we did see a name, do we know if that person worked for that company? Was it one of their company vehicles? And then again, why the hell is their laundry truck parked right there?
And if you see if you don't see a name, it would probably play into the idea that those kind of things would have been scrubbed from any film or picture, right?
There you go.
If it's significant, it's not going to be seen, you know?
That's right. That's right. You're absolutely right, Brooks. Well, I tell you what, we're coming up on
dinner.
Yeah, it's been a delightful afternoon. I think I'm going to bring the meeting to a close. I want to thank everybody that came out today, and I think we had a great, meeting, great discussion, great ideas shared back and forth. I want to tell you guys and also the people on YouTube that'll be watching this replay later tomorrow. Hey, they get an extra hour of sleep. They can check out our 3-hour video. Definitely sign up for the conference. Sign up for the Evening of Remembrance on the 21st. These are important things. We're doing what we need to do to put on the events, and we need the support of our fellow researchers, whether they've never been to our event before or whether this is their first time. So continue doing the work that you guys are doing. We're going to continue the work that we're doing. I want to thank you guys on behalf of Casey Quinlan, Brian Edwards, myself. We will see you again. Nothing else, we will definitely see you again during the conference and the evening on the 21st. And then our next journey meeting will be scheduled sometime in the month of December, past my finals and, around Christmas.
David, you and I have to get together.
Yes, I need to get together with you on Larry's digitized version of the JFK Horseman book will be available at the conference. I'm working on a cover for him. Is that what you want to talk about, Larry?
Yeah, in private.
Okay, that, and also want to make sure that your video or your PowerPoint plays correctly at the conference this year.
Yeah, we're going to install the open office this week.
That sounds great. Well, until again, I want to bid you all adieu. Thanks again for everybody, coming out on the YouTube videos. Make sure you like, subscribe. Erica, you got your hand up. You got one more thing to add?
I was just clapping. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And, hey, I just see a hand pop up. I want to make sure I call on anybody that puts it up. But thanks again, everybody, and we will see you. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Don't forget.
I won't forget. I'll call you. I promise.
Okay.